Fever Dream by George R. R. Martin. Copyright 1982 by George R. R. Martin. Narrated by David Palmer. Annotation. A chilling tale of terror evokes the picturesque years and grand legends of the steamboat era. The story involves a noble vampire, his corrupt and powerful blood master, a talkative steamboat captain, and the haunting power of the Mississippi River. Strong language. From the book jacket. Fever Dream is a rich, evocative tale of a noble vampire's quest to unite his race with humanity, of a garrulous steamboat captain's dream of immortality, of the grand legends of the steamboat era, and of the haunting power of the ancient river. Abner Marsh, a grizzled giant of a riverboatman, is left stranded and penniless after the icy winter of 1857 destroys his dilapidated fleet. When the aristocratic Joshua York offers him partnership and enough gold to build the fastest steamboat on the Mississippi, it is a dream come true for Abner. But it is not until the maiden voyage of the stately new sidewheeler Fever Dream that Abner discovers, to his horror, that his pale intellectual partner is a vampire, and that Abner's own plans to make history as the fastest steamboat captain on the river must play second fiddle to York's noble mission. York is traveling downriver to gather members of his ancient maligned race in order to free them from their heritage of bloodthirsty violence. But first he must overcome a corrupt and powerful bloodmaster who awaits him in a crumbling bayou plantation. Abner Marsh decides to stay on with his partner, little realizing that with every passing mile, his dream ship is plunging them deeper and deeper into nightmare. About the author. George Martin is the author of 5 books and is the winner of 3 Hugo Awards and 1 Nebula Award. He is a contributor to Omni Magazine and Analog, and is a book reviewer for the Washington Post. He has also been a college instructor, a chess tournament director, a Vista volunteer, and a sports writer. Mr. Martin lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Other books by George R. R. Martin. A Song for Laya and Other Stories. Songs of Stars and Shadows. Dying of the Light. Sand Kings. Windhaven, with Lisa Tuttle. Dedication. For Howard Waldrop. A hell of a writer, a hell of a friend, and a fevered dreamer if ever there was one. Chapter 1. St. Louis, April 1857. Abner Marsh rapped the head of his hickory walking stick smartly on the hotel desk to get the clerk's attention. "I'm here to see a man named York," he said. "Josh York, I believe he calls himself. You got such a man here?" The clerk was an elderly man with spectacles. He jumped at the sound of the rap, then turned and spied Marsh and smiled. "Why, it's Captain Marsh," he said amiably. "Ain't seen you for 1/2 year, Captain. Heard about your misfortune, though. Terrible, just terrible. I've been here since 36, and I never seen no ice jam like that one." "Never you mind about that," Marsh said, annoyed. He had anticipated such comments. The Planter's House was a popular hostelry among steamboatmen. Marsh himself had dined there regularly before that cruel winter. But since the ice jam, he'd been staying away, and not only because of the prices. Much as he liked Planter's House food, he was not eager for its brand of company. Pilots and captains and mates, rivermen all, old friends and old rivals, and all of them knowing his misfortune. Abner Marsh wanted no man's pity. "You just say where York's room is," he told the clerk peremptorily. The clerk bobbed his head nervously. "Mr. York won't be in his room, Captain. You'll find him in the dining room taking his meal." "Now? At this hour?" Marsh glanced at the ornate hotel clock and loosed the brass buttons of his coat and pulled out his own gold pocket watch. 10 past midnight, he said, incredulous. "You say he's eaten?" "Yes, sir, that he is. He chooses his own times, Mr. York, and he's not the sort you say no to, Captain." Abner Marsh made a rude noise deep in his throat, pocketed his watch, and turned away without a word, setting off across the richly appointed lobby with long, heavy strides. He was a big man, and not a patient one, and he was not accustomed to business meetings at midnight. He carried his walking stick with a flourish, as if he had never had a misfortune, and was still the man he had been. The dining room was almost as grand and lavish as the main saloon on a big steamer, with cut-glass chandeliers and polished brass fixtures, and tables covered with fine white linen and the best china and crystal. During normal hours, the tables would have been full of travelers and steamboatmen, but now the room was empty, most of the lights extinguished. Perhaps there was something to be said for midnight meetings after all, Marsh reflected. At least he would have to suffer no condolences. Near the kitchen door, two Negro waiters were talking softly. Marsh ignored them and walked to the far side of the room, where a well-dressed stranger was dining alone. The man must have heard him approach, but he did not look up. He was busy spooning up mock turtle soup from a china bowl. The cut of his long black coat made it clear he was no riverman, an Easterner then, or maybe even a foreigner. He was big, Marsh saw, though not near so big as Marsh. Seated, he gave the impression of height, but he had none of Marsh's girth. At first, Marsh thought him an old man, for his hair was white. Then, when he came closer, he saw that it was not white at all, but a very pale blonde. And suddenly, the stranger took on an almost boyish aspect. York was clean-shaven, not a mustache nor side whiskers on his long, cool face, and his skin was as fair as his hair. He had hands like a woman, Marsh thought, as he stood over the table. He tapped on the table with his stick. The cloth muffled the sound, made it a gentle summons. "You Josh York?" he said. York looked up, and their eyes met. Till the rest of his days were done, Abner Marsh remembered that moment, that first look into the eyes of Joshua York. Whatever thoughts he had had, whatever plans he had made, were sucked up in the maelstrom of York's eyes. Boy and old man and dandy and foreigner, all those were gone in an instant, and there was only York, the man himself, the power of him, the dream, the intensity. York's eyes were gray, startlingly dark in such a pale face. His pupils were pinpoints, burning black, and they reached right into Marsh and weighed the soul inside him. The gray around them seemed alive, moving, like fog on the river on a dark night, when the banks vanish and the lights vanish, and there is nothing in the world but your boat and the river and the fog. In those mists, Abner Marsh saw things. Visions swift glimpsed and then gone. There was a cool intelligence peering out of those mists. But there was a beast as well, dark and frightening, chained and angry, raging at the fog. Laughter and loneliness and cruel passion. York had all of that in his eyes. But mostly there was force in those eyes, terrible force, a strength as relentless and merciless as the ice that had crushed Marsh's dreams. Somewhere in that fog, Marsh could sense the ice moving, slow, so slow, and he could hear the awful splintering of his boats and all his hopes. Abner Marsh had stared down many a man in his day, and he held his gaze for the longest time, his hand closed so hard around his stick that he feared he would snap it in two, but at last he looked away. The man at the table pushed away his soup, gestured, and said, "Captain Marsh, I have been expecting you. Please join me." His voice was mellow, educated, easy. "Yes," Marsh said, too softly. He pulled out the chair across from York and eased himself into it. Marsh was a massive man, 6 foot tall and 300 pounds heavy. He had a red face and a full black beard that he wore to cover up a flat, pushed-in nose and a face full of warts. But even the whiskers didn't help much. They called him the ugliest man on the river, and he knew it. In his heavy blue captain's coat, with its double row of brass buttons, he was a fierce and imposing figure. But York's eyes had drained him of his bluster. The man was a fanatic, Marsh decided. He had seen eyes like that before in madmen and hell-raising preachers, and once in the face of the man called John Brown down in Bleeding, Kansas. Marsh wanted nothing to do with fanatics, with preachers and abolitionists and temperance people. But when York spoke, he did not sound like a fanatic. "My name is Joshua Anton York, Captain. J.A. York in business, Joshua to my friends. I hope that we shall be both business associates and friends in time." His tone was cordial and reasonable. "We'll see about that," Marsh said, uncertain. The gray eyes across from him seemed aloof and vaguely amused, no? Whatever he had seen in them was gone. He felt confused. "I trust you received my letter." "I got it right here," Marsh said, pulling the folded envelope from the pocket of his coat. The offer had seemed an impossible stroke of fortune when it arrived, salvation for everything he feared lost. Now he was not so sure. "You want to go into the steamboat business, do you?" he said, leaning forward. A waiter appeared. "Will you be dining with Mr. York, Captain?" "Please do," York urged. "I believe I will," Marsh said. York might be able to outstare him, but there was no man on the river could out-eat him. "I'll have some of that soup, and a dozen oysters, and a couple of roast chickens with taters and stuff. Crisp 'em up good, mind you. And something to wash it all down with. What are you drinking, York?"
"Burgundy."
"Fine. Fetch me a bottle of the same." York looked amused. "You have a formidable appetite, Captain."
"This is a formidable town," Marsh said carefully. "And a formidable river, Mr. York. Man's got to keep his strength up. This ain't New York nor London, neither."
"I'm quite aware of that," York said.
"Well, I hope so, if you're going into steamboating. It's the formidablest thing of all."
"Shall we go directly to business, then? You own a packet line. I wish to buy a half interest. Since you are here, I take it you are interested in my offer."
"I'm considerable interested," Marsh agreed, "and considerable puzzled, too. You look like a smart man. I reckon you checked me out before you wrote me this here letter."
He tapped it with his finger.
"You ought to know that this last winter just about ruined me."
York said nothing, but something in his face bid Marsh continue.
"The Fever River Packet Company, that's me," Marsh went on. "Called it that on account of where I was born, up on the Fever near Galena. Not 'cause I only worked that river, since I didn't. I had 6 boats, working mostly the upper Mississippi trade, St. Louis to St. Paul, with some trips up the Fever and the Illinois and the Missouri. I was doing just fine, adding a new boat or two most every year, thinking of moving into the Ohio trade, or maybe even New Orleans. But last July, my Mary Clark blew a boiler and burned up near to Dubuque. Burned right to the waterline with 100 dead. And this winter, this was a terrible winter, I had 4 of my boats wintering here at St. Louis. The Nicholas Perot, the Dunleith, the Sweet Fever, and my Elizabeth A., brand new, only 4 months in service, and a sweet boat, too, near 300 feet long, with 12 big boilers, fast as any steamboat on the river. I was real proud of my lady Liz. She cost me $200,000, but she was worth every penny of it." The soup arrived. Marsh tasted a spoonful and scowled. "Too hot," he said. "Well, anyway, St. Louis is a good place to winter. Don't freeze too bad down here, nor too long. This winter was different, though. Yes, sir. Ice jam. Damn river froze hard." Marsh extended a huge red hand across the table, palm up, and slowly closed his fingers into a fist. "Put an egg in there and you get the idea, York. Ice can crush a steamboat easier than I can crush an egg. When it breaks up, it's even worse. Big gorges sliding down the river, smashing up wharfs, levees, boats, most everything. Winter's end, I'd lost my boats. All 4 of them. The ice took them away from me."
"Insurance?" York asked. Marsh set to his soup, sucking it up noisily. In between spoons, he shook his head.
"I am not a gambling man, Mr. York. I never took no stock in insurance. It's gambling, all it is. Except you're betting against yourself. What money I made, I put into my boats. York nodded. I believe you still own one steamboat. That I do, Marsh said. He finished his soup and signaled for the next course. The Eli Reynolds, a little 150-ton sternwheeler. I've been using her on the Illinois, because she don't draw much, and she wintered in Peoria, missed the worst of the ice. That's my asset, sir. That's what I got left. Trouble is, Mr. York, the Eli Reynolds ain't worth much. She only cost me $25,000 new, and that was back in 50. 7 years, York said. Not a very long time. Marsh shook his head. 7 years is a powerful long time for a steamboat, he said. Most of them don't last but 4 or 5. River just eats them up. The Eli Reynolds was better built than most, but still she ain't got that long left. Marsh started in on his oysters, scooping them up on the half-shell and swallowing them whole, washing each one down with a healthy gulp of wine. So I'm puzzled, Mr. York, he continued after a half-dozen oysters had disappeared. You want to buy a half-share in my line, which ain't got but one small old boat. Your letter named a price, too high a price. Maybe when I had 6 boats, then Beaver River Packets was worth that much, but not now. He gulped down another oyster. You won't earn back your investment in 10 years. Not with the Reynolds. She can't take enough freight, nor passengers neither. Marsh wiped his lips on his napkin and regarded the stranger across the table. The food had restored him, and now he felt like his old self again, in command of the situation. York's eyes were intense, to be sure, but there was nothing there to fear. You need my money, Captain, York said. Why are you telling me this? Aren't you afraid I will find another partner? I don't work that way, Marsh said. Been on the river 30 years, York. Rafted down to New Orleans when I was just a boy, and worked flatboats and keelboats both before steamers. I've been a pilot and a mate and a striker, even a mud clerk. Been everything there is to be in this business, but one thing I never been, and that's a sharper. An honest man, York said, with just enough of an edge in his voice so Marsh could not be sure if he was being mocked. I am glad you saw fit to tell me the condition of your company, Captain. I knew it already, to be sure. My offer stands. Why? Marsh demanded gruffly. Only a fool throws away money. You don't look like no fool. The food arrived before York could answer. Marsh's chickens were crisped up beautifully, just the way he liked them. He sawed off a leg and started in hungrily. York was served a thick cut of roasted beef, red and rare, swimming in blood and juice. Marsh watched him attack it deftly, easily. His knife slid through the meat as if it were butter, never pausing to hack or saw, as Marsh so often did. He handled his fork like a gentleman, shifting hands when he set down his knife. Strength and grace. York had both in those long, pale hands of his, and Marsh admired that. He wondered that he had ever thought them a woman's hands. They were white, but strong. Hard, like the white of the keys of the grand piano in the main cabin of the Eclipse. Well, Marsh prompted, you ain't answered my question. Joshua York paused for a moment. Finally, he said, you have been honest with me, Captain Marsh. I will not repay your honesty with lies, as I had intended, but I will not burden you with the truth, either. There are things I cannot tell you, things you would not care to know. Let me put my terms to you under these conditions and see if we can come to an agreement. If not, we shall part amiably. Marsh hacked the breast off his second chicken. Go on, he said. I ain't leaving. York put down his knife and fork and made a steeple of his fingers. For my own reasons, I want to be master of a steamboat. I want to travel the length of this great river, in comfort and privacy, not as passenger, but as captain. I have a dream, a purpose. I seek friends and allies. And I have enemies, many enemies. The details are none of your concern. If you press me about them, I will tell you lies. Do not press me. His eyes grew hard for a moment, then softened as he smiled. Your only interest need be my desire to own and command a steamboat, Captain. As you can tell, I am no riverman. I know nothing of steamboats or the Mississippi, beyond what I have read in a few books and learned during the weeks I have spent in St. Louis. Obviously, I need an associate, someone who is familiar with the river and river people, someone who can manage the day-to-day operations of my boat and leave me free to pursue my own purposes. This associate must have other qualities as well. He must be discreet, as I do not wish to have my behavior, which I admit to be sometimes peculiar, become the talk of the levee. He must be trustworthy, since I will give all management over into his hands. He must have courage. I do not want a weakling, or a superstitious man, or one who is overly religious. Are you a religious man, Captain?
No, said Marsh. Never cared for Bible thumpers, nor them for me.
York smiled. Pragmatic. I want a pragmatic man. I want a man who will concentrate on his own part of the business and not ask too many questions of me. I value my privacy, and if sometimes my actions seem strange or arbitrary or capricious, I do not want them challenged. Do you understand my requirements?
Marsh tugged thoughtfully on his beard.
And if I do? We will become partners, York said. Let your lawyers and your clerks run your line. You will travel with me on the river. I will serve as captain. You can call yourself pilot, mate, co-captain, whatever you choose. The actual running of the boat I will leave to you. My orders will be infrequent, but when I do command, you will see to it that I am obeyed without question. I have friends who will travel with us, cabin passage, at no cost. I may see fit to give them positions on the boat with such duties as I may deem fitting. You will not question these decisions. I may acquire other friends along the river and bring them aboard as well. You will welcome them. If you can abide by such terms, Captain Marsh, we shall grow rich together and travel your river in ease and luxury. Abner Marsh laughed. Well, maybe. But it ain't my river, Mr. York. And if you think we're going to travel in luxury on the old Eli Reynolds, you're going to be awful sore when you come on board. She's a rackety old tub with some pretty poor accommodation, and most times she's full of foreigners taking deck passage to one unlikely place or the other. I ain't been on her in 2 years. Old Captain Yerger runs her for me now. But last time I rode her, she smelled pretty bad. You want luxury, you ought to see about buying into the Eclipse or the John Simons.
Joshua York sipped at his wine and smiled.
I did not have the Eli Reynolds in mind, Captain Marsh.
She's the only boat I got.
York set down his wine. Come, he said, let us settle up here. We can proceed up to my room and discuss matters further. Marsh made a weak protest. The planter's house offered an excellent dessert menu, and he hated to pass it up. York insisted, however. York's room was a large, well-appointed suite, the best the hotel had to offer, and usually reserved for rich planters up from New Orleans. Sit, York said commandingly, gesturing Marsh to a large, comfortable chair in the sitting room. Marsh sat while his host went into an inner chamber and returned a moment later, bearing a small iron-bound chest. He set it on a table and began to work the lock. Come here, he said. But Marsh had already risen to stand behind him. York threw back the lid.
Gold,
Marsh said softly. He reached out and touched the coins, running them through his fingers, savoring the feel of the soft yellow metal, the gleam and the clatter of it. One coin he brought to his mouth and tasted. Real enough, he said, spitting. He chunked the coin back in the chest. $10,000 in $20 gold coins, York said. I have two other chests just like it. and letters of credit from banks in London, Philadelphia, and Rome for sums considerably larger. Accept my offer, Captain Marsh, and you shall have a second boat, one far grander than your Eli Reynolds. Or perhaps I should say that we shall have a second boat. He smiled. Abner Marsh had meant to turn down York's offer. He needed the money bad enough, but he was a suspicious man with no use for mysteries, and York asked him to take too much on faith. The offer had sounded too good. Marsh was certain that danger lay hidden somewhere, and he would be the worse for it if he accepted. But now, staring at the color of York's wealth, he felt his resolve weakening. "A new boat, you say?" he said weakly. "Yes," York replied, "and that is over and above the price I would pay you for a half interest in your packet line." "How much?" Marsh began. His lips were dry. He licked them nervously. "How much are you willing to spend to build this new boat, Mr. York?" "How much is required?" York asked quietly. Marsh took up a handful of gold coins, then let them rattle through his fingers back into the chest. The gleam of them, he thought. But all he said was, "You oughtn't carry this much about with you, York. There's scoundrels would kill you for one of them coins." "I can protect myself, Captain," York said. Marsh saw the look in his eyes and felt cold. He pitied the robber who tried to take Joshua York's gold. "Will you take a walk with me on the levee?" "You haven't given me my answer, Captain." "You'll get your answer. Come first. Got something I want you to see." "Very well," York said. He closed the lid of the chest, and the soft yellow gleam faded from the room, which suddenly seemed close and dim. The night air was cool and moist. Their boots sent up echoes as they walked the dark, deserted streets, York with a limber grace and Marsh with heavy authority. York wore a loose pilot's coat cut like a cape, and a tall old beaver hat that cast long shadows in the light of the half-moon. Marsh glared at the dark alleys between the bleak brick warehouses and tried to present an aspect of solid scowling strength sufficient to scare off ruffians. The levee was crowded with steamboats, at least 40 of them tied up to landing posts and wharf boats. Even at this hour, all was not quiet. Huge stacks of freight threw black shadows in the moonlight, and they passed roustabouts lounging against crates and bales of hay, passing a bottle from hand to hand, or smoking their cob pipes. Lights still burned in the cabin windows of a dozen or more boats. The Missouri packet Wyandotte was lit and building steam. They spied a man standing high up on the Texas deck of one big side-wheel packet, looking down at them curiously. Abner Marsh led York past him, past the procession of darkened, silent steamers, their tall chimneys etched against the stars like a row of blackened trees with strange flowers on their tops. Finally, he stopped before a great ornate side-wheeler, freight piled high on her main deck, her stage raised against unwanted intruders as she nuzzled against her weathered old wharf-boat. Even in the dimness of the half-moon, the splendor of her was clear. No steamer on the levee was quite so big and proud. "Yes," Joshua York said quietly, respectfully. That might have decided it right there, Marsh thought later, the respect in his voice. "That's the Eclipse," Marsh said. "See, your name is on the wheelhouse there." He jabbed with his stick. "Can you read it?" "Quite well. I have excellent night vision." "This is a special boat, then?" "Hell yes, she's special. She's the Eclipse. Every goddamn man and boy on this river knows her. Old now, she was built back in 52, 5 years ago, but she's still grand. Cost $375,000, so they say, and worth all of it. There ain't never been a bigger, fancier, more formidable boat than this one right here. I've studied her, taken passage on her, I know." Marsh pointed. "She measures 365 feet by 40, and her grand saloon is 330 feet long, and you never seen nothing like it. Got a gold statue of Henry Clay at one end,
and Andy Jackson at the other. The two of them glaring at each other the whole damn way. More crystal and silver and colored glass than the planter's house ever dreamed of. Oil paintings, food like you ain't never tasted. And mirrors. Such mirrors. And all that's nothing to her speed. Down below, on the main deck, she carries 15 boilers. Got an 11-foot stroke, I tell you. And there ain't a boat on any river can run with her when Captain Sturgeon gets up her steam. She's done 18 miles an hour upstream, easy. Back in 53, she set the record from New Orleans to Louisville. I know her time by heart. 4 days, 9 hours, 30 minutes. And she beat the goddamn A.L. Shotwell by 50 minutes, fast as the Shotwell is. Marsh rounded to face York. I hoped my Lady Liz would take the Eclipse someday, beat her time, or race her head to head. But she never could have done it, I know that now. I was just fooling myself. I didn't have the money it takes to build a boat that can take the Eclipse. You give me that money, Mr. York, and you've got yourself a partner. There's your answer, sir. You want half of Fever River Packets, and a partner who runs things quiet and don't ask you no questions about your business? Fine. Then you give me the money to build a steamboat like that. Joshua York stared at the big side-wheeler, serene and silent in the darkness, floating easily on the water, ready for all challengers. He turned to Abner Marsh with a smile on his lips and a dim flame in his dark eyes. Done, was all he said, and he extended his hand. Marsh broke into a crooked, snaggle-toothed grin, wrapped York's slim white hand within his own meaty paw, and squeezed. Done, then, he said loudly, and he brought all his massive strength to bear, squeezing and crushing, as he always did in business, to test the will and the courage of the men he dealt with. He squeezed until he saw the pain in their eyes. But York's eyes stayed clear, and his own hand clenched hard around Marsh's with a strength that was surprising. Tighter and tighter it squeezed, and the muscles beneath that pale flesh coiled and corded like springs of iron. And Marsh swallowed hard and tried not to cry out. York released his hand. Come, he said, clapping Marsh solidly across the shoulders and staggering him a bit. We have plans to make. Chapter 2. New Orleans, May 1857. Sour Billy Tipton arrived at the French Exchange just after 10 and watched them auction 4 casks of wine, 7 crates of dry goods, and a shipment of furniture before they brought in the slaves. He stood silently, elbows up against the long marble bar that extended halfway around the rotunda, sipping an absinthe while he observed the encanteurs hawk their wares in 2 languages. Sour Billy was a dark, cadaverous man, his long, horse face scarred by the pox he'd had as a boy, his hair thin and brown and flaky. He seldom smiled, and he had frightening, ice-colored eyes. Those eyes, those cold and dangerous eyes, were Sour Billy's protection. The French Exchange was a grand place, altogether too grand for his tastes, and for a fact he did not like to come there. It was in the rotunda of the St. Louis Hotel, beneath a towering dome from which daylight cascaded down onto auction block and bidders. The dome was 80 feet across easily. Tall pillars circled the room. Galleries ran round the inside of the dome. The ceiling was elaborate and ornamental. The walls were covered with odd paintings. The bar was solid marble. The floor was marble. The desks of the encanteurs were marble. The patrons were as fine as the decor, rich planters from upriver, and young Creole dandies from the old city. Sour Billy loathed the Creoles, them with their rich clothes and haughty ways and dark, contemptuous eyes. He did not like to go among them. They were hot-blooded and quarrelsome, much given to dueling, and sometimes one of the young ones would take offense at Sour Billy, at the way he mangled their language and looked at their women.
at the disreputable, scruffy, presumptuous Americanness of him. But then they would catch sight of his eyes, pale and staring and edged with malice, and often as not they would turn away. Still, left to his own devices, he'd do his nigger buying over at the American Exchange in the St. Charles, where manners were less refined, English was spoken in place of French, and he felt less out of place. The grandeur of the Rotunda and the St. Louis did not impress him, except for the quality of the drinks they served. He came there once a month, nonetheless, and had no choice about it. The American Exchange was a good place to buy a field hand or a cook, dark-skinned as you please, but for a fancy girl, one of the young, dusky, octoroon beauties that Julian preferred, you had to come to the French Exchange. Julian wanted beauty, insisted on beauty. Sour Billy did as Damon Julian told him. It was about 11 when the last of the wine was cleared away, and the traders began to bring in their merchandise from the slave pens on Moreau and Esplanade and Common Streets. Men and women, old and young, and children too, a disproportionate number of them light of skin and fair of face, intelligent as well, Sour Billy knew, probably French-speaking. They were lined up along one side of the room for inspection, and several of the young Creole men walked along the row jauntily, making light comments to one another and viewing today's stock at close hand. Sour Billy stayed by the bar and ordered another absinthe. He had visited most of the yards yesterday, looking over what there was to offer. He knew what he wanted. One of the auctioneers brought down a mallet on his marble desk, and at once the patrons ceased their conversation and turned to give him their attention. He gestured, and a young woman of about 20 climbed unsteadily to the top of a nearby crate. She was a slight quadroon with wide eyes, pretty in her way. She wore a calico dress and had green ribbons in her hair, and the auctioneer began singing her praises effusively. Sour Billy watched with disinterest while two young Creoles bid her up. She was finally sold for some $1,400. Next, an older woman, said to be a fine cook, was auctioned off, and then a young mother with two children all sold together. Sour Billy waited through several other sales. It was a quarter past noon when the French Exchange was jammed with bidders and spectators when the item he had chosen came up. Her name was Emily, the encanteur told them. Look at her, sirs, he babbled in French. Just look at her. Such perfection. It has been years since such a lot has been sold here. Years. And it will be years before we see another like her. Sour Billy was inclined to agree. Emily was 16 or 17, he judged, but already very much a woman. She looked a little frightened up on the auction block, but the dark simplicity of her dress set off her figure to good advantage, and she had a beautiful face, big, soft eyes, and fine café au lait skin. Julian will like this one. The bidding was spirited. The planters had no use for such a fancy girl, but 6 or 7 of the Creoles were hot after her. No doubt the other slaves had given Emily some idea what might be in store for her. She was pretty enough to get her freedom in time, and to be kept by one of those fine Creole dandies in a little house on Rampart Street, at least until he married. She'd go to the quadroon balls in the Orleans ballroom, wear silk gowns and ribbons, be the cause of more than one duel. Her daughters would have skin even lighter, and grow into the same fine life. Maybe when she got old, she'd learn to dress hair or run a boarding house. Sour Billy sipped at his drink, cold-faced. The bids rose. By $2,000, all but 3 of the bidders had fallen out. At that point, one of them, a swarthy, bald-headed man, demanded that she be stripped. The encanteur snapped a curt command, and Emily gingerly undid her dress and stepped out of it. Someone shouted up a lewd compliment that drew a round of laughter from the audience. The girl smiled weakly while the auctioneer grinned and added a comment of his own. Then the bidding resumed. At $2,500, the bald-headed man dropped out, having gotten his look. That left 2 bidders, both Creoles. They topped one another three times in succession, forcing the price up to $3,200. Then came the hesitation. The auctioneer coaxed a final bid from the younger of the two men. $3,300.
$3,400,
his opponent said quietly. Sour Billy recognized him. He was a lean young Creole named Montfree, a notorious gambler and duelist. The other man shook his head. The auction was over. Montfree was smirking at Emily with anticipation. Sour Billy waited three heartbeats until the mallet was about to fall. Then he set aside his absinthe glass and said,
$3,700,
in a loud, clear voice. Enconteur and girl both looked up in surprise. Montfree and several of his friends gave Billy dark, threatening looks.
$3,800,
Montfree said.
$4,000,
said Sour Billy. It was a high price, even for such a beauty. Montfree said something to two men standing near him, and the three of them suddenly spun on their heels and strode from the rotunda without another word, their footsteps ringing angrily on the marble.
It seems like I won the auction,
Sour Billy said.
Get her dressed and ready to go.
The others were all staring at him.
But of course, the Enconteur said.
Another auctioneer rose at his desk and with his mallet summoned yet another fancy girl to the attention of the crowd, and the French exchange began to buzz again. Sour Billy Tipton led Emily down the long arcade from the rotunda to St. Louis Street, past all the fashionable shops where idlers and wealthy travelers gave them curious looks. As he stepped out into daylight, blinking at the glare, Montfree came up beside him.
Monsieur, he began.
Talk English if you want to talk to me, Sour Billy said sharply.
It's Mr. Tipton out here, Montfree.
His long fingers twitched, and he fixed the other with his cold, ice eyes.
Mr. Tipton, Montfree said in a flat, unaccented English.
His face was vaguely flushed. Behind him, his two companions stood stiffly.
I have lost girls before, the Creole said. She is striking, but it is nothing losing her. But I take offense at the way you bid, Mr. Tipton. You made a mockery of me in there, taunting me with victory and playing me for a fool.
Well, well, Sour Billy said.
Well, well. You play a dangerous game,
Montfree warned.
Do you know who I am? If you were a gentleman, I would call you out, sir.
Dueling's illegal, Montfree, Sour Billy said.
Hadn't you heard? And I'm no gentleman.
He turned back to the quadroon girl, who was standing up near the wall of the hotel, watching them.
Come, he said.
He walked off down the sidewalk, and she followed.
You shall be paid in kind for this, monsieur, Montfree called after him.
Sour Billy paid him no mind and turned a corner. He walked briskly, a swagger in his step that had been absent inside the French exchange. The streets were where Sour Billy felt at home. There he had grown up. There he had learned to survive. The slave girl Emily scurried after him as best she could, her bare feet pounding on the brick sidewalks. The streets of the Vieux Carré were lined with brick and plaster houses, each with its graceful wrought-iron balcony overhanging the narrow walk, fancy as you please. But the roads themselves were unpaved, and the recent rains had turned them into a sea of mud. Along the walks were open gutters, deep ditches of cypress full of standing water, fragrant with filth and raw sewage. They passed neat little shops and slave pens with heavily barred windows, past elegant hotels and smoky grog shops full of surly free niggers, past close, humid alleys and airy courtyards, each with its well or fountain, past haughty Creole ladies with their escorts and chaperones, and a gang of runaway slaves in iron collars and chains, cleaning the gutters under the careful watch of a hard-eyed white man with a whip. Shortly they passed out of the French Quarter entirely, into the raw, newer American section of New Orleans. Sour Billy had left his horse tied up outside a grog shop. He mounted it and told the girl to walk along beside him. They struck out south from the city, and soon left the main roads, stopping only once, briefly, so Sour Billy could rest his horse and eat some of the dry, hard bread and cheese in his saddlebag. He let Emily suck up some water from a stream.
"Are you my new master, sir?"
she asked him then, in remarkably good English. "Overseer," said Sour Billy. "You'll meet Julian tonight, girl. After dark," he smiled. "He'll like you." Then he told her to shut up. Since the girl was afoot, their pace was laggardly, and it was near dusk when they reached the Julian plantation. The road ran along the bayou and wound through a thick stand of trees, limbs heavy with Spanish moss. They rounded a large barren oak and came out into the fields, red-tinged in the somber light of the setting sun. They lay fallow and overgrown from the water's edge to the house. There was an old rotting wharf and a woodyard along the bayou for passing steamers, and behind the great house a row of slave shanties. But there were no slaves, and the fields had not been worked in some years. The house was not large, as plantation houses go, nor particularly grand. It was a stolid, square structure of graying wood, paint flaking from its sides, its only striking aspect a high tower with a widow's walk around it. "Home," said Sour Billy. The girl asked if the plantation had a name. "Used to," Sour Billy said, "years ago when Garou owned it. But he took sick and died, him and all his fine sons. And it don't got no name now. Now shut your mouth and hurry." He led her around back to his own entrance and opened the padlock with a key he wore on a chain around his neck. He had three rooms of his own and the servants' portion of the house. He pulled Emily into the bedroom. "Get out of them clothes," Sour Billy snapped. The girl fumbled to obey but looked at him with fear in her eyes. "Don't look like that," he said. "You're Julian's. I ain't going to mess with you. I'll be heating some water. There's a tub in the kitchen. You'll wash the filth off you and dress." He threw open a wardrobe of intricately carved wood, pulled out a dark brocade gown. "Here, this'll fit." She gasped.
"I can't wear nothing like that. That's a white lady's dress."
"You shut your mouth and do like I tell you," Sour Billy said. "Julian wants you pretty, girl." Then he left her and went through into the main part of the house. He found Julian in the library, sitting quietly in darkness in a great leather chair, a brandy snifter in his hand. All around him, covered with dust, were the books that had belonged to old René Garou and his sons. None of them had been touched in years. Damon Julian was not a reader. Sour Billy entered and stood a respectful distance away, silent until Julian spoke. "Well?" the voice from the darkness asked at last.
4,000, Sour Billy said. "But you'll like her. A young one, nice and tender, beautiful.
Real beautiful."
"The others will be here soon. Alan and Jean are here already, the fools. The thirst is on them. Bring her to the ballroom when she is ready."
"Yes," Sour Billy said quickly. "There was trouble at the auction, Mr. Julian."
"Trouble?"
"A Creole sharper, name of Montree. He wanted her too, didn't like being outbid. Think he might get curious. He's a gambler, seen a lot around the gaming rooms. Want me to take care of him some night?"
"Tell me about him," Julian commanded. His voice was liquid, soft, and deep, and sensuous, rich as a fine cognac.
"Young, dark, black eyes, black hair, tall. A duelist, they say. Hard man. Strong and lean, but he's got a pretty face like so many of them do."
"I will see to him," Damon Julian said.
"Yes, sir," said Sour Billy Tipton. He turned and went back to his rooms.
Emily was transformed when she slipped into the brocade gown. Slave and child alike vanished. Washed and dressed properly, she was a woman of dark, almost ethereal beauty. Sour Billy inspected her carefully.
"You'll do," he said. "Come, you're going to a ball."
The ballroom was the largest and grandest chamber in the house, lit by 3 huge cut-glass chandeliers burning with 100 tiny candles. Bayou landscapes done in rich oils hung on the walls, and the floors were beautifully polished wood. At one end of the room, wide double doors opened out onto a foyer. At the other, a great staircase rose and branched off to either side, its banisters gleaming. They were waiting when Sour Billy led her in. 9 of them were on hand, including Julian himself. 6 men, 3 women, the men in dark suits of European cut, the women in pale silken gowns. Except for Julian, they waited on the staircase, still and silent, respectful. Sour Billy knew them all, the pale women who called themselves Adrienne and Cynthia and Valerie, dark, handsome Raymond with the boy's face, Kurt, whose eyes burned like hot coals, all the others. One of them, Jean, trembled slightly as he waited, his lips pulled back from long white teeth, his hand moving in small spasms. The thirst was on him badly, but he did not act. He waited for Damon Julian. All of them waited for Damon Julian. Julian walked across the ballroom to the slave girl, Emily. He moved with the stately grace of a cat. He moved like a lord, like a king. He moved like darkness flowing, liquid and inevitable. He was a dark man, somehow, though his skin was very pale. His hair was black and curling, his clothing somber, his eyes glittering flint. He stopped before her and smiled. Julian had a charming, sophisticated smile. "Exquisite," he said simply. Emily blushed and stammered. "Shut up," Sour Billy told her sharply. "Don't you talk unless Mr. Julian tells you to." Julian ran his finger along one soft, dark cheek, and the girl trembled and tried to stand still. He stroked her hair languidly, then raised her face toward his and let his eyes drink from her own. At that, Emily shied and cried out with alarm, but Julian placed his hands on either side of her face and would not let her look away. "Lovely," he said. "You are beautiful, child. We appreciate beauty here, all of us." He released her face, took one of her small hands in his own, raised it, and turned it over and bowed to plant a soft kiss on the inside of her wrist. The slave girl was still shaking, but she did not resist. Julian turned her slightly and gave her arm to Sour Billy Tipton. "Will you do the honors, Billy?" Sour Billy reached behind him and pulled the knife from the sheath in the small of his back. Emily's dark eyes bulged wide and frightened, and she tried to pull away, but he had a firm grip on her, and he was fast, very fast. The blade had scarcely come into view, and suddenly it was wet. A single swift slash across the inside of her wrist, where Julian had planted his lips. Blood welled from the wound and began to drip onto the floor, the patter is loud in the stillness of the ballroom. Briefly, the girl whimpered, but before she quite knew what was happening, Sour Billy had sheathed his knife and stepped away, and Julian had taken her hand again. He raised her slim arm up once more and bent his lips to her wrist and began to suck. Sour Billy retreated to the door. The others left the stair and came closer, the women's gowns whispering softly. They stood in a hungry circle about Julian and his prey, their eyes dark and hot. When Emily lost consciousness, Sour Billy sprang forward and caught her beneath the arms, supporting her. She weighed almost nothing at all. "Such beauty," Julian muttered when he broke free of her, lips moist, eyes heavy and sated. He smiled. "Please, Damon," implored the one called Jean, shaking like a man with the fever. Blood ran slowly, darkly down Emily's arm, as Julian gave Jean a cold, malignant stare. "Valerie," he said, "you are next." The pale young woman with the violet eyes and yellow gown came forward, knelt daintily, and began to lick at the terrible flow. Not until she had licked the arm clean did she press her mouth to the open wound. Raymond went next, by Julian's leave, then Adrian, then George. Finally, when the others were done, Julian turned to Jean with a smile and a gesture. He fell on her with a stifled sob, wrenching her from Sour Billy's embrace, and began to tear at the soft flesh of her throat. Damon Julian grimaced with distaste. "When he is done," he told Sour Billy, "clean it up." Chapter 3, New Albany, Indiana, June 1857. The mists were thick on the river and the air damp and chilly. It was just after midnight when Joshua York, finally arrived from St. Louis, met Abner Marsh in the deserted boatyards of New Albany. Marsh had been waiting for almost half an hour when York appeared, striding out of the fog like some pale apparition. Behind him, silent as shadows, came four others. Marsh grinned toothily. "Joshua?" he said. He nodded curtly to the others. He had met them briefly back in April in St. Louis before he had taken passage to New Albany to supervise the building of his dream. They were York's friends and traveling companions, but an odder bunch Marsh had never met. Two of them were men of indeterminate age with foreign names that he could neither remember nor pronounce. He called them Smith and Brown, to York's amusement. They were always yapping at each other in some outlandish gibble-gabble. The third man, a hollow-cheeked Easterner who dressed like a mortician, was called Simon and never spoke at all. The woman, Catherine, was said to be a Britisher. She was tall and kind of stooped, with a sickly, decaying look to her. She reminded Marsh of a great white vulture. But she was York's friend, all of them were, and York had warned him that he might have peculiar friends, so Abner Marsh held his tongue. "Good evening, Abner," York said. He stopped Ards, where the half-built steamers lay like so many skeletons amid the gray, flowing mists. "Cold night, isn't it, for June?" "That it is. You come far?" "I've taken a suite at the Galt House over in Louisville. We hired a boat to take us across the river." His cool gray eyes studied the nearest steamboat with interest. "Is this 1 hour?" Marsh snorted. "This little thing? Hell no, that's just some cheap sternwheeler they're building for the Cincinnati trade. You don't think I'd put no damn sternwheel on our boat, do you?" York smiled. "Forgive my ignorance. Where is our boat, then?" "Come this way," Marsh said, gesturing broadly with his walking stick. He led them half across the boatyard. "There," he said, pointing. The mists gave way for them, and there she stood, high and proud, dwarfing all the other boats around her. Her cabins and rails gleamed with fresh paint, pale as snow, bright even in the gray shroud of fog. Way up on her Texas roof, halfway to the stars, her pilot house seemed to glitter. A glass temple, its ornate cupola, decorated all around with fancy woodwork as intricate as Irish lace. Her chimneys, twin pillars that stood just forward of the Texas deck, rose up 100 feet, black and straight and haughty. Their feathered tops bloomed like two dark metal flowers. Her hull was slender and seemed to go on forever, with her stern obscured by the fog. Like all the first-class boats, she was a side-wheeler. Set amidship, the huge curved wheelhouses loomed gigantic, hinting at the vast power of the paddle-wheels concealed within them. They seemed all the larger for want of the name that would soon be emblazoned across them. In the night and the fog, amid all those smaller, plainer boats, she seemed a vision, a white phantom from some riverman's dream. She took the breath away, Marsh thought, as they stood there. Smith was gibbling and Brown was gabbling back at him, but Joshua York just looked. For the longest time he looked, and then he nodded. "We have created something beautiful, Abner," he said. Marsh smiled. "I had not expected to find her so close to finished," York said. "This is New Albany," said Marsh. "That's why I came here instead of one of the boatyards in St. Louis. They've been building steamboats here since I was a boy. Built 22 of them just last year. Probably have almost that many this year. I knew they could do the job for us. You should have been here.
I came in with one of those little chests of gold, and I dumped it all over the superintendent's desk. And I says to him, I says, I want a steamer built, and I want it built quick. And I want it to be the fastest and prettiest and best damned heller of a boat that you ever damn built, you hear? Now you get me some engineers, your best. I don't care if you got to drag them out of some cat house over to Louisville. You get them to me tonight, so we can begin. And you get me the best damn carpenters and painters and boilermakers and all the damn rest. Because if I get anything but the best, you're going to be a mighty sorry man. Marsh laughed. You should have seen him. Didn't know whether to look at that gold or listen to me. Both scared him half to death. But he did us right, that he did. He nodded toward the boat. Of course, she's not finished. Trim needs to be painted. Going to do it up mostly in blue and silver. To go with all that silver you wanted in the saloon. And we're still waiting on some of the fancy furniture and mirrors you ordered from Philadelphia and such things. But mostly she's done, Joshua. Mostly she's ready. Come, I'll show you.
Workman had abandoned a lantern atop a pile of lumber near the stern of the boat. Marsh struck a match on his leg, lit the lantern, and thrust it imperiously at Brown.
Here, you, carry this, he said brusquely.
He went clomping heavily up a long board onto the main deck, the others trailing behind.
Careful what you touch, he said. Some of the paint's still wet.
The lowest, or main deck, was full of machinery. The lantern burned with a clear, steady light, but Brown kept moving it around so the shadows of the hulking machines seemed to shift and jump ominously, as if they were things alive.
Here, hold that still, Marsh commanded.
He turned to York and began to point, his stick jabbing like a long hickory finger toward the boilers, great metal cylinders that ran along either side of the forepart of the deck.
18 boilers, Marsh said proudly. 3 more than the Eclipse. 38-inch diameters, 28-foot long, each of them.
His stick waggled.
Furnaces are all done up with fire brick and sheet iron. Got them up on brackets, clear of the deck. Cuts down on the chance of fires.
He traced the path of the steam lines overhead, running from the boilers back to the engines, and they all turned toward the stern.
We got 36-inch cylinders, high pressure, and we got ourselves an 11-foot stroke, same as the Eclipse. This boat is going to chew up that old river something terrible, I tell you.
Brown gabbled, Smith gibbled, and Joshua York smiled.
Come on up, Marsh said. Your friends don't seem too interested in the engines, but they ought to like it just fine upstairs.
The staircase was wide and ornate, polished oak with graceful fluted banisters. It began up near the bow, its width hiding the boilers and engines from those boarding, then broke in two and curled gracefully to either side to open on the second or boiler deck. They walked along the starboard side, with Marsh and his stick and Brown and the lantern leading the way, their boots clacking on the hardwood deck of the promenade as they marveled at the fine Gothic detail of the pillars and the guardrails, all the painstakingly shaped wood, carved with flowers and curlicues and acorns. Stateroom doors and windows ran fore and aft in a long, long row. The doors were dark walnut, the windows stained glass.
Staterooms aren't furnished yet, Marsh said, opening a door and leading them into one. But we're getting nothing but the best. Feather beds and feather pillows, a mirror and an oil lamp for each room. Our cabins are larger than usual, too. Won't be able to take quite as many passengers as some other boat our size, but they'll have more room, he smiled. We can charge them more, too.
Each cabin had 2 doors, one leading out onto the deck, the other inward, to the grand saloon, the main cabin of the steamer.
Main cabin isn't near finished, Marsh said. But come look at it anyway.
They entered and stopped, while Brown raised the lantern to cast light all up and down the vast, echoing length of it. The grand saloon extended the length of the boiler deck, continuous and unobstructed except by a midship gangway.
Fore portion is the gents' cabin,
Aft for the ladies, Marsh explained. Take a look. Ain't done yet, but she'll be something. That marble bar there is 40 foot long, and we're going to put a mirror behind it just as big. Got it on order now. We'll have mirrors on every stateroom door, too, with silver frames around them, and a 12 foot high mirror there at the aft end of the ladies' cabin. He pointed upward with his stick. Can't see nothing now, with it being dark and all, but the skylights are stained glass, run the whole length of the cabin. We're going to put down one of them Brussels carpets, and carpets in all the staterooms, too. We got a silver water cooler with silver cups that's going to stand on a fancy wooden table, and we got a grand piano, and brand new velvet chairs, and real linen tablecloths. None of it is here yet, though. Even empty of carpeting, mirrors, and furniture, the long cabin had a splendor to it. They walked down it slowly, in silence, and in the moving light of the lantern, bits of its stately beauty suddenly took form from the darkness, only to vanish again behind them. The high arched ceiling, with its curving beams, carved and painted with detail as fine as fairy lace. Long rows of slim columns flanking the stateroom doors, trimmed with delicate fluting. The black marble bar with its thick veins of color. The oily sheen of dark wood. The double row of chandeliers, each with four great crystal globes hanging from a spider web of wrought iron, wanting only oil and a flame and all those mirrors to wake the whole saloon to glorious glittering light. I thought the cabin's too small, Catherine said suddenly. But this room will be grand. Marsh frowned at her. The cabins are big, ma'am. 8 foot square. 6 as usual. This is a steamer, you know. He turned away from her, pointing with his walking stick. Clerk's office will be all the way forward there. The kitchen and the washrooms are by the wheelhouses. I know just the cook I want to get, too. Used to work on my Lady Liz. The roof of the boiler deck was the hurricane deck. They walked up a narrow stair and emerged forward of the great black iron smokestacks, then up a shorter stair to the Texas deck, which ran back from the stacks to the wheelhouses. Crew's cabins, Marsh said, not bothering with a tour. The pilot house stood atop the Texas. He led them up and in. From here the whole yards were visible, all the lesser boats wrapped in mist, the black waters of the Ohio River beyond, and even the distant lights of Louisville, ghostly flickers in the fog. The interior of the pilot house was large and plush. The windows were of the best and clearest glass, with stained glass trim around them. Everywhere shone dark wood and polished silver, pale and cold in the lantern light. And there was the wheel. Only the top half of it was visible, so huge was it, and even that stood as high as Marsh himself, while the bottom half was set in a slot in the floorboards. It was fashioned of soft black teak, cool and smooth to the touch, and the spokes wore ornamental silver bands like a dance hall girl wears garters. The wheel seemed to cry out for a pilot's hands. Joshua York came up to the wheel and touched it, running a pale hand over the black wood and silver. Then he took hold of it, as if he were a pilot himself. And for a long moment he stood like that, the wheel in his hands and his gray eyes brooding as they stared out into the night and the unseasonable June fog. The others all fell silent, and for a brief moment Abner Marsh could almost feel the steamboat move over some dark river of the mind on a voyage strange and endless. Joshua York turned then and broke the spell. Abner, he said, I would like to learn to steer this boat. Can you teach me to pilot? Pilot, huh? Marsh said, surprised. He had no difficulty imagining York as a master and a captain, but piloting was something else. Yet somehow the very asking made him warm to his partner, made him understandable after all. Abner Marsh knew what it was to want to pilot. Well, Joshua, he said, I've done my share of piloting, and it's the grandest feeling in the world. Being a captain, that ain't nothing to piloting. But it ain't something you just pick up, if you know what I'm saying.
The wheel looks simple enough to master, York said.
Marsh laughed.
Hell yes, but it's not the wheel you got to learn. It's the river, York, the river. The old Mississippi itself. I was a pilot for 8 years before I got my own boats, licensed for the upper Mississippi and the Illinois. Never for the Ohio, though, or the lower Mississippi. And for all I knew about steamboating, I couldn't have piloted no boat on those rivers to save my life. Didn't know 'em. Those I did know, it took me years to learn 'em. And the learning never stopped. By now, I've been out of the pilot house for so long that I'd have to learn 'em all over again. The river changes, Joshua. That it does. Ain't never the same twice in a row. And you got to know every inch of it.
Marsh strolled to the wheel and put one of his own hands on it fondly.
Now, I plan to pilot this boat at least once. I dreamed about her too long not to want to take her in my hands. When we go against the Eclipse, I mean to stand a spell in the pilot house, that I do. But she's too grand a boat for anything but the New Orleans trade, and that means the lower river. So I'm going to have to start learning myself. Learn every damn foot. Takes time. Takes work.
He looked at York.
You still want a pilot now that you know what it means?
We can learn together, Abner, York replied. York's companions were growing restless. They wandered from window to window, Brown shifting the lantern from one hand to another, Simon as grim as a cadaver. Smith said something to York in their foreign tongue. York nodded.
We must be going back, he said.
Marsh glanced around one final time, reluctant to leave even now, and led them from the pilot house. When they had trudged part way through the boatyards, York turned and looked back toward their steamboat where she sat on her pilings, pale against the darkness. The others stopped as well and waited silently.
"Do you know Byron?"
York asked Marsh.
Marsh thought a minute. "Know a fellow named Blackjack Pete used to pilot on the Grand Turk. I think his last name was Brian."
York smiled.
"Not Brian. Byron. Lord Byron, the English poet."
"Oh," said Marsh.
"Him. I'm not much a one for poems. I think I heard of him, though. Gimp, wasn't he? And quite a one for the ladies?"
"The very one, Abner.
An astounding man. I had the good fortune to meet him once. Our steamboat put me in mind of a poem he once wrote."
He began to recite. "She walks in beauty like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies." "Byron wrote of a woman, of course, but the words seem to fit our boat as well, do they not? Look at her, Abner. What do you think?"
Abner Marsh didn't quite know what to think. Your average steamboatman didn't go around spouting poetry, and he didn't know what to say to one that did.
"Very interesting, Joshua," was all he managed.
"What shall we name her?"
York asked, his eyes still fixed on the boat and a slight smile on his face.
"Does the poem suggest anything?"
Marsh frowned.
"We're not going to name her after any gimp Britisher, if that's what you're thinking," he said gruffly.
"No," said York. "I wasn't suggesting that. I had in mind something like Dark Lady, or..."
"I had something in mind myself," Marsh said. "We're Fever River Packets, after all, and this boat is all I ever dreamed come true."
He lifted his hickory stick and pointed at the wheelhouse.
"We'll put it right there. Big blue and silver letters, real fancy. Fever Dream."
He smiled.
"Fever Dream against the Eclipse. They'll talk about that race till all of us are dead."
For a moment, something strange and haunted moved in Joshua York's gray eyes. Then it was gone as swiftly as it had come.
"Fever Dream," he said. "Don't you think that choice a bit,
oh, ominous?
It suggests sickness to me. Fever and death and twisted visions.
Dreams that should not be dreamed, Abner." Marsh frowned.
I don't know about that. I like it.
Will people ride in a boat with such a name? Steamboats have been known to carry typhoid and yellow fever. Do we wish to remind them of such things?
They rode my sweet fever, Marsh said. They ride the War Eagle and the Ghost, even boats named after Red Indians. They'd ride her.
The gaunt, pale one named Simon said something then in a voice that rasped like a rusty saw and a language strange to Marsh, though it was not the one Smith and Brown babbled in. York heard him, and his face took on a thoughtful cast, though it still seemed troubled.
Fever dream, he said again.
I had hoped for a healthier name, but Simon has made a point to me. Have your way, then, Abner. The fever dream she is.
Good, Marsh said.
York nodded absently.
Let us meet tomorrow for dinner at the Galt House at 8. We can make plans for our voyage to St. Louis, discuss crew and provisioning, if that is agreeable to you.
Marsh voiced a gruff assent, and York and his companions went off toward their boat, vanishing into the mists. Long after they had gone, Marsh stood in the boatyards, staring at the still, silent steamer.
Fever dream, he said loudly,
just to test the taste of the words on his tongue. But oddly, for the first time, the name seemed wrong in his ears, fraught with connotations he did not like. He shivered unaccountably cold for a moment, then snorted and set off for bed. Chapter 4. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Ohio River, July 1857. The Fever Dream left New Albany by dark, on a sultry night early in July. In all his years on the river, Abner Marsh had never felt so alive as he did that day. He spent the morning attending to last-minute details in Louisville and New Albany, hiring a barber and lunching with the men from the boatyards, and posting a handful of letters. In the heat of the afternoon, he settled into his cabin, made a last check round the steamer to make certain everything was right, and greeted some of the cabin passengers as they arrived. Supper was a rushed affair, and then he was off to the main deck to check the engineer and the strikers, checking the boilers, and to supervise the mate as he supervised the loading of the last of the cargo. The sun beat down relentlessly, and the air hung thick and still, so the roustabouts gleamed with sweat as they carried crates and bales and barrels up the narrow loading planks, the mate cussing at them all the while. Across the river to Louisville, Marsh knew, other steamers were departing or loading up as well. The big, low-pressure Jacob Strader of the Cincinnati Mail Line, the Swift Southerner of the Cincinnati and Louisville Packet Company, a half-dozen smaller boats. He watched to see if any of them went down the river, feeling awful good despite the heat and the swarms of mosquitoes that had risen from the river when the sun went down. The main deck was crammed with cargo fore and aft, filling most all the space not taken up by the boilers and furnaces and engines. She was carrying 150 tons of bale leaf tobacco, 30 tons of bar iron, countless barrels of sugar and flour and brandy, crates of fancy furniture for some rich man in St. Louis, a couple blocks of salt, some bolts of silk and cotton, 30 barrels of nails, 18 boxes of rifles, some books and papers and sundries. And lard. 1 dozen big barrels of the finest lard. But the lard wasn't cargo properly. Marsh had bought it himself and ordered it stowed on board. The main deck was crammed with passengers as well, men and women and children, thick as the river mosquitoes, swarming and milling amid the cargo. Near 300 of them had crowded on, paying $1 each for passage to St. Louis. Passage was all they got. They ate what food they brought on board with them, and the lucky ones found a place to sleep on the deck. They were mostly foreigners, Irish and Swedes and big Dutchmen, all yelling at each other in languages Marsh didn't know, drinking and cussing and slapping their kids. A few trappers and common laborers were down there as well, too poor for anything but deck passage at Marsh's bargain rates. The cabin passengers had paid a full $10, at least those who were going all the way to St. Louis. Almost all the cabins were full, even at that rate. The clerk told Marsh they had 177 cabin passengers aboard, which Marsh figured had to be a good number, with all those sevens in it. The roster included a dozen planters, the head of a big St. Louis fur company, two bankers, a rich Britisher, and his three daughters, and four nuns going to Iowa. They also had a preacher on board, but that was all right, since they weren't carrying no gray mare. It was well known among rivermen that having a preacher and a gray mare on board was an invitation to disaster. As for the crew, Marsh was right pleased with it. The two pilots now were nothing special, but they were only hired on temporary to take the steamer to St. Louis, since they were Ohio River pilots, and the Fever Dream was going to work the New Orleans trade. He had already written letters to St. Louis and New Orleans, and he had a couple of lightning lower Mississippi pilots waiting for them at the planter's house. The rest of the crew, though, were as good as any steamboatman on any river anywhere, Marsh was sure. The engineer was Whitey Blake, a peppery little man whose fierce white whiskers always had grease stains in them from the engines. Whitey had been with Abner Marsh on the Eli Reynolds, and later on the Elizabeth A. and the Sweet Fever, and there wasn't no one understood a steam engine better than he did. Jonathan Jeffers, the clerk, had gold spectacles and slicked-back brown hair and fancy button gaiters, but he was a terror at ciphering and dickering. Never forgot anything, struck a mean bargain, and played a meaner game of chess. Jeffers had been in the line's main office until Marsh had written him to come down to the Fever Dream. He'd come right away. For all of his dandified appearance, Jeffers was a riverman through to his dark, ciphering soul. He carried a gold-handled sword cane, too. The cook was a free colored man named Toby Lanyard, who had been with Marsh 14 years, ever since Marsh tasted his cooking down in Natchez, bought him, and gave him his freedom. And the mate, who was named Michael Theodore Dunn, though nobody ever called him anything but Harry Mike, except for the roustabouts who called him Mr. Dunn, sir, was one of the biggest and meanest and stubbornest men on the river. He was well over 6 foot tall, with green eyes and black whiskers and thick black curly hair all over his arms and legs and chest. He had a foul mouth and a bad temper, and never went no place without his 3-foot-long black iron billet. Abner Marsh had never seen Harry Mike hit anyone with that billet, except once or twice, but it was always wrapped in his hand, and there was talk among the roustabouts that he'd once split open the head of a man who'd dropped a cask of brandy in the river. He was a hard, fair mate, and no one dropped anything when he was watching. Everyone on the river respected the hell out of Harry Mike Dunn. It was a damn fine crew, those men on the Fever Dream. Right from the first day, they all did their jobs. So by the time the stars were all out over New Albany, the cargo and the passengers were on board and on the records. The steam was up, and the furnaces were roaring with a terrible ruddy light and enough heat to make the main deck warmer than Natchez under the hill on a good night. And a fine meal was a-cooking in the kitchen. Abner Marsh checked it all, and when he was satisfied, he climbed on up to the pilot house, which stood resplendent and dignified above all the chaos and bellowing below. "Back her out," he said to his pilot. And the pilot called down for some steam, and set the two great side wheels to backing. Abner Marsh stood back of him respectfully, and the Fever Dream slid smoothly out onto the black, starlit waters of the Ohio. Once out in the river, the pilot reversed the wheels and turned her to downstream, and the big steamer vibrated a little and slipped into the main channel, easy as you please, the wheels going chunka-chunka, chunka-chunka, as they churned and roiled the water, the boat moving along faster and faster, with the speed of the current and her own steam sparkling along swift as a steamboater's dream, swift as sin, swift as the eclipse herself. Above their heads, the chimneys gave off two long streamers of black smoke, and clouds of sparks flew out and vanished behind them, settling to the river to die like so many red and orange fireflies. To Abner Marsh's eyes, the smoke and steam and sparks they trailed behind them were a finer, grander sight than all the fireworks they'd seen in Louisville on the 4th. The pilot reached up and sounded their steam whistle then, and the long, shrill scream of it deafened them. It was a wonderful whistle, with a wild, keening edge to it and a blast that could be heard for miles. Not until the lights of Louisville and New Albany disappeared behind them, and the fever dream was steaming between banks as black and empty as they'd been a century ago, did Abner Marsh become aware that Joshua York had come up to the pilot house and was standing by his side. He was done up all fine, in trousers and tailcoat of the purest white, with a deep blue vest, a white shirt full of ruffles and fancies, and a blue silk tie. The watch chain that stretched across his vest was silver, and on one pale hand York wore a big silver ring with a bright blue stone set in it, gleaming. White and blue and silver, those were the boat's colors, and York looked a part of her. The pilot house was hung with showy blue and silver curtains, and the big stuffed couch to the back of it was blue, and the oilcloth, too.
"Why, I like your get-up, Joshua," Marsh said to him. York smiled. "Thank you," he said. "It seemed appropriate. You look striking as well."
Marsh had bought himself a new pilot's jacket with shiny brass buttons and a cap with the steamer's name embroidered on it in silver thread.
"Yeah," Marsh replied.
He was never at ease with compliments. Cussing was easier and more comfortable to him.
"Well," he said, "were you up when we left?"
York had been sleeping in the captain's cabin on the Texas deck most of the day, while Marsh sweated and worried and performed most of the captain's actual duties. Marsh had slowly grown accustomed to the way York and his companions lived up the nights and slept during the day. He'd known others who'd done the same, and the one time he'd asked York about it, Joshua had just smiled and spouted that poem about gaudy day at Marsh again.
"I was standing on the hurricane deck, forward of the chimneys, watching everything. It was cool up there once we got underway."
"The fast steamer makes her own wind," Marsh said. "Don't matter how hot the day is or how fierce the wood's burning. It's always fine and cool up above. Sometimes I feel a mite sorry for those down on the main deck. But what the hell, they are only paying a dollar."
"Of course," Joshua York agreed. The boat gave a heavy thunk just then and shook slightly.
"What was that?" York asked. "We just run over a log, probably," Marsh replied.
"That so?"
he asked the pilot.
"Grazed it," the man replied. "Don't fret, Captain, no damage done."
Abner Marsh nodded and turned back to York.
"Well, should we be going on down to the main cabin? The passengers will all be up and about, seeing as how this is the first night out, so we can meet a few of them, talk them up, see that everything is good and proper."
"I'd be glad to," York replied. "But first, Abner, will you join me in my cabin for a drink? We ought to celebrate our departure, don't you agree?"
Marsh shrugged.
"A drink? Well, I don't see why not."
He tipped his cap at the pilot.
"Good night, Mr. Daly. I'll have some coffee sent up for you, if you'd like."
They left the pilot house and repaired to the captain's cabin, pausing for a moment while York unlocked the door. He had insisted that his cabin, and indeed all the staterooms on the boat, have good locks. That was a bit peculiar, but Marsh had been willing to acquiesce. York wasn't used to life on a steamer, after all, and most of his other requests had been sensible enough, like all that silver and the mirrors that made the main saloon such a splendid place. York's cabin was 3 times the length of the passenger staterooms and twice as wide, so, by steamer standards, it was immense. But this was the first time Abner Marsh had been inside it since York had taken possession, so he looked around curiously. A pair of oil lamps on opposite sides of the cabin gave the interior a warm, cozy light. The wide, stained-glass windows were dark now, shuttered off and curtained with heavy black velvet that looked soft and rich in the lamplight. In one corner was a tall chest of drawers, with a basin of water set atop it, and a silver-framed mirror on the wall. There was a narrow but comfortable-looking feather bed, and 2 big leather chairs, and a great wide rosewood desk with lots of drawers and nooks and crannies. It stood flush against one wall. Above it, a fine old map of the Mississippi River system had been tacked up. The top of the desk was covered with leather-bound ledgers and piles of newspapers.
That was another of Joshua York's peculiarities. He read an inordinate number of newspapers from just about all over. Papers from England, papers in foreign languages, Mr. Greeley's Tribune, of course, and the Herald from New York as well, just about all the St. Louis and New Orleans papers, and all kinds of little river town weeklies. He got packets of newspapers delivered to him every day. Books, too. There was a tall bookcase in the cabin, and it was crammed full, and more books were stacked up on the little table by the bed, with a half-melted reading candle on top of them. Abner Marsh didn't waste time looking at books, though. Next to the bookcase was a wooden wine rack, with 20 or 30 bottles lying neatly on their sides. He went directly to it and pulled out a bottle. The bottle was unlabeled, and the liquid within was a somber red, so dark it was almost black. A cap of shiny black wax sealed the cork on. "You got a knife?" he asked York, turning with the bottle in his hand. "I don't think you'd care much for that vintage, Abner," York said. He was holding a tray with 2 silver goblets and a crystal decanter. "I have some excellent sherry here. Why don't we have that instead?" Marsh hesitated. York's sherry was usually just fine, and he hated to pass it up, but knowing Joshua, he figured that any wine he kept a private stock of had to be superlative. Besides, he was curious. He shifted the bottle from one hand to the other. The liquid within flowed slowly, creeping along languidly like some sweet liqueur. "What is this, anyway?" Marsh asked, frowning. "A home brew of sorts," York replied. "Part wine and part brandy and part liqueur. Tasting like none of them. A rare drink, Abner. My companions and I have a fondness for it, but most people find it not to their liking. I'm sure you'd prefer the sherry." "Well," Marsh said, hefting the bottle, "anything you drink is probably just fine for me, Joshua. You do serve up good sherry, though, that's true enough." He brightened. "Say, we're in no hurry, and I got myself a fierce thirst. Why don't we try both?" Joshua York laughed, a laugh of pure, spontaneous delight, deep and musical. "Abner," he said, "you are singular and most formidable. I like you. You, however, will not like my little drink. Still, if you insist, we shall have both." They settled themselves into the 2 leather chairs, York putting the tray on the low table between them. Marsh handed over the bottle of wine, or whatever it was. From somewhere within the pristine folds of his white suit, York produced a skinny little knife, with an ivory handle and a long silver blade. He sliced away the wax and, with one single deft twist, flicked the knife point into the cork and brought it out with a pop. The liquor poured slowly, flowing like red-black honey into the silver goblets. It was opaque and seemed full of tiny black specks. Strong, though. Marsh lifted his goblet and sniffed at it, and the alcohol in it brought tears to his eyes. "We ought to have a toast," York said, lifting his own goblet. "To all the money we're going to make," Marsh joked. "No," York said seriously. Those demon gray eyes of his had a kind of grave melancholy in them, Marsh thought. He hoped that York wasn't going to start reciting poetry again. "Abner," York continued, "I know what the fever dream means to you. I want you to know that she means much to me as well. This day is the start of a grand new life for me. You and I together, we made her what she is, and we shall go on to make her a legend. I have always admired beauty, Abner, but this is the first time in a long time that I have created it, or helped in its creation. It is a good feeling to bring something new and fine into the world, particularly for me. And I have you to thank for it." He lifted his goblet. "Let us drink for the fever dream and all she represents, my friend. Beauty, freedom, hope. To our boat and a better world." "To the fastest steamer on the river," Marsh replied. And they drank. He almost gagged. York's private drink went down like fire, searing the back of his throat and spreading warm tendrils in his innards. But there was a kind of cloying sweetness to it as well, and a hint of an unpleasant smell that all its strength and sweetness could not quite conceal. Tasted like something had rotted in a bottle, he thought. Joshua York drained his own goblet in a single long motion, his head thrown back. Then he set it aside and looked at Marsh and laughed again. "The look on your face, Abner, is wonderfully grotesque. Don't feel you have to be polite. I warned you. Why don't you have some sherry?"
"I believe I will," Marsh replied. "I do believe I will."
Later, when two glasses of sherry had wiped the aftertaste of York's drink from Marsh's mouth, they got to talking. "What is our next step after St. Louis, Abner?" York asked.
"The New Orleans trade. Ain't no other run for a boat as grand as this one."
York gave an impatient shake of his head.
"I know that, Abner. I was curious about how you intend to realize your dream of beating the Eclipse. Will you seek her out and issue a challenge?"
"I'm willing, so long as it does not delay us unduly or take us out of our way."
"Wish it were that simple, but it ain't. Hell, Joshua, there's thousands of steamers on the river, and all of them would like to beat the Eclipse. She's got runs to make, just like we do. Passengers and freight to move. Can't be just racing all the time. Anyhow, our captain be a fool to listen to any challenge from us. Who are we, anyway? Some new steamer fresh out of New Albany that nobody ever heard of? Eclipse would have everything to lose and nothing to gain by racing us."
He emptied another glass of sherry and held it out to York for a refill.
"No, first we got to work our trade, build ourselves a reputation. Get known up and down the river as a fast boat. Pretty soon, folks will get to talking about how fast she is, and get to wondering how Fever Dream and Eclipse would match up. Maybe we run into her on the river a couple of times, say, and pass her up. We build up the talk, and folks start to betting. Maybe we make some of the runs the Eclipse makes, and we beat her time. A fast steamer gets the trade, you know. The planters and shippers and such, they want to get their wares to market soon as they can. So they go with the fastest boat around. And passengers, why, they all love to ride on a famous boat if they got the money. So what happens, you see, is that after a time people start thinking we're the fastest boat on the lower river, and the trade starts moving our way. And the Eclipse gets hurt a little where it counts, and the purse. Then you just watch how easy we get us a race, to prove once and for all who's faster."
"I see," said York. "Is this run to St. Louis going to start our reputation, then?"
"Well, I ain't trying for no record time. She's a new boat, and we got to break her in. Don't even have our regular pilots on board yet. No one is real familiar with how she handles. And we got to give Whitey time to work out all the little problems with the engines and get his strikers trained proper."
He set down his empty glass.
"Don't mean we can't start in some other ways, though," he said, smiling. "Got something or other in mind along those lines. You'll see."
"Good," said Joshua York.
"More sherry?"
"No,"
Marsh said. "We ought to get on down to the saloon, I think. I'll buy you a drink at our bar. Guarantee you it'll taste better than that damned stuff of yours."
York smiled.
"My pleasure," he said.
That night was not like other nights for Abner Marsh. It was a magic night, a dream. There seemed to be at least 40 or 50 hours in it. He could have sworn, and each of them was priceless. He and York were up till dawn, drinking and talking up a storm, wandering all over the wonder of a boat they had built. The day after, Marsh woke with such a head that he could barely recall half of what he'd done the night before. But some moments were indelible in his memory. He remembered entering the Grand Saloon, and it was better than entering the finest hotel in the world. The chandeliers were brilliant, lamps aglow and prisms glittering. The mirrors made the long, narrow cabin seem twice as wide as it really was. A crowd was gathered around the bar, talking politics and such, and Marsh joined them for a while and listened to them complain about abolitionists and argue over whether Stephen A. Douglas ought to be president, while York said hello to Smith and Brown, who were at one of the tables playing cards with some planters and a notorious gambler. Someone was tinkling on the grand piano. Stateroom doors opened and closed all the time, and the whole place was bright with light and laughter. Later, they went down to a different world on the main deck. Cargo piled everywhere, roustabouts and deckers asleep on coils of rope and bags of sugar. A family gathered around a little fire they'd built, cooking something or other. A drunk passed out behind the stairs. The engine room was awash in the hellish red glow of the furnaces, and Whitey was in the middle of it all, with his shirt soaked by sweat and grease in his beard, bellowing at his strikers to be heard above the hiss of the steam and the chunka-chunka of the wheels churning water. The rods were awesome, moving back and forth in their long, powerful strokes. They watched for a while, York and he, until the heat and smell of machine oil got to be too much for them. Sometime later, they were up on the hurricane deck, passing a bottle between them, strolling and talking in their own cool wind. The stars were bright as a lady's diamonds overhead. The Thieves River banner was flapping on both fore and verge flagpoles, and the river around them was blacker than the blackest slave Marsh had ever seen. They ran all night, daily standing the long watch up in the pilot house, keeping them moving at a smart clip, though nothing to what they could do if pressed, Marsh knew, along the dark Ohio, with nothingness all around them. It was a charmed run, with no snags or sawyers or sandbars to bedevil them. Only twice did they have to send out a yawl ahead of them for soundings, and both times they found good water when they dropped lead, and the fever dream steamed on. A few houses were glimpsed on the shore, most dark and shuttered for the night, but one with a light burning in a high window. Marsh wondered who was awake up there, and what they thought when the steamer went on by. She must have been a fine sight, with her decks all lit and the music and laughter drifting out over the water, the sparks and smoke from her chimneys, and her name, big on the wheelhouse, Fever Dream, done all in thick fancy blue lettering with silver trim around it. He almost wished he was on shore just to see it. The big excitement of the night came just before midnight, when they first sighted another steamer churning water ahead of them. When Marsh saw, he took York by the elbow and led him on up to the pilot house. It was crowded up there, Daly still at the wheel, sipping coffee, two other pilots and three passengers sitting on the couch behind him. The pilots weren't nobody hired by Marsh, but pilots rode free if they wanted to. That was a custom of the river. And they usually rode in the pilot house to chat with the man at the wheel and keep up on the river. Marsh ignored them. "Mr. Daly," he said to his pilot. "There's a steamer up ahead." "I see it, Captain Marsh," Daly replied with a laconic grin. "Wonder what boat that is. You got any idea, Daly?" Whatever boat it wasn't much. Some squat stern-wheeler with a pilot house square as a cracker box. "Sure don't," the pilot replied. Abner Marsh turned to Joshua York. "Joshua," he said, "you're the real captain now, and I don't want to be giving you too many suggestions, but the truth is, I'm awful curious as to what steamer that is on up ahead of us. Why don't you tell Daly here to catch her for us, so I can relax a bit?" York smiled. "Certainly," he said. "Mr. Daly, you heard Captain Marsh. Do you think the Fever Dream can catch that boat on ahead?" "She can catch anything," the pilot said. He called down to the engineer for more steam, and pulled the steam whistle again, and the wild banshee scream echoed over the river, as if to warn the steamer up ahead that the Fever Dream was coming after her. The blast was enough to bring all the passengers out of the main saloon onto the deck. It even got the deck passengers up off their bags of flour. A couple of passengers came wandering up and tried to enter the pilot house, but Marsh chased them all down below again, along with the three who'd already been up there. As passengers will, all of them rushed to the front of the boat, and later to the larboard side, when it became clear that was the side they'd passed the other boat on. "Damn passengers," Marsh muttered to York. "Never will trim boat. One of these days, they'll all rush to the same side and tip some poor steamer right on over, I swear it. For all his complaining, Marsh was delighted. Whitey was chucking in more wood down below, the furnaces were roaring, and the big wheels moved faster and faster. It was over in hardly no time at all. The fever dream seemed to eat up the miles between her and the other boat, and when she passed her, a ragged cheer came up from the lower decks, sweet music to Marsh's ears. As they surged past the small stern wheeler, York read her name off the pilot house. "She seems to be the Mary Kay," he said. "Well, boil me for an egg," Marsh said. "Is she a well-known boat?" York asked. "Hell no," Marsh said. "I never heard of her. Can you beat that?" Then he laughed uproariously and clapped York on the back, and before long everyone in the pilot house was laughing. Before the night was over, the fever dream had caught and passed a half dozen steamers, including one sidewheeler near as big as she was. But it never got as exciting as that first time, catching the Mary Kay. "You wanted to know how we'd begin it?" Marsh said to York when they left the pilot house. "Well, Joshua, it's begun." "Yes," said York, glancing back behind them, where the Mary Kay was growing small in the distance. "Indeed it has." Chapter 5. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Ohio River, July 1857. Headache or no, Abner Marsh was too good a riverman to sleep away the day, especially a day as important as this one. He sat up in bed around 11, after a scant few hours' sleep, splashed some tepid water on his face from the basin on the nightstand, and dressed. There was work to be done, and York wouldn't be up and around till dusk. Marsh set his cap on his head, scowled at himself in the mirror, and fluffed out his beard a little, then gathered up his walking stick and lumbered on down from the Texas to the boiler deck. He visited the washrooms first, then ducked back to the kitchen. "Missed breakfast, Toby," he said to the cook, who was already preparing dinner. "Have one of your boys fix me up a half dozen eggs and a slab of ham, and send it on up to the Texas deck, will you? Coffee, too. Lots of coffee." In the grand saloon, Marsh had a quick drink or two, which made him feel somewhat better. He mumbled a few polite words at passengers and waiters, then hastened back to the Texas to wait for his food. After he'd eaten, Abner Marsh felt like his old self again. He climbed on up to the pilot house after breakfast. The watch had changed, and the other pilot was at the wheel, with only one of the freeloaders keeping him company. "Morning, Mr. Kitch," Marsh said to his pilot. "How's she drawing?" "I ain't complaining," the pilot replied. He glanced at Marsh. "This here boat of yours is a frisky one, Captain. You take her down to New Orleans, you better get yourself some good pilots. She takes a good hand at the wheel, she does." Marsh nodded. That wasn't unexpected. Frequently, the faster boats were hard to handle. It didn't bother him. No pilot who didn't know what he was about was going to get anywhere near the Fever Dream's wheel. "What kind of time we making?" Marsh asked. "Smart enough," the pilot replied with a shrug. "She can do better, but Mr. Daly said you weren't in no hurry, so we're just lazing along." "Put in at Paducah when we get there," Marsh ordered. "Got a couple passengers to set off and some freight to discharge." He spent a few minutes chatting with the pilot and finally went on back down to the boiler deck. The main cabin had been set up for dinner. Bright noon sunlight was pouring from the skylights in a cascade of colors, and beneath it a long row of tables ran the length of the cabin. The waiters were setting silverware and china. Crystal glasses gleamed brilliantly in the light. From the kitchen, Marsh caught hints of the most marvelous mouth-watering smells. He paused and found himself a menu, glanced over it, and decided he was still hungry. Besides, York wasn't about yet, and it was only fitting that one of the captains join the cabin passengers and other officers for dinner. The dinner, Marsh thought, was excellent. Marsh put away a big plate of roast lamb and parsley sauce, a small pigeon, lots of Irish potatoes and green corn and beets, and two pieces of Toby's famous pecan pie. By the time dinner was over, he was feeling quite amiable. He even gave the preacher permission to give a little lecture on bringing Christianity to the Indians, though he didn't normally hold with no Bible thumping on his boats. Had to keep the passengers amused somehow, Marsh figured. And even the prettiest scenery got boring after a while. Early in the afternoon, the Fever Dream put into Paducah, which lay on the Kentucky side of the river, where the Tennessee emptied into the Ohio. It was their third stop on the run, but the first lengthy one. They'd put in briefly at Rossboro during the night to drop off three passengers, and they'd taken on wood and a small amount of freight at Evansville while Marsh had been asleep. But they had to discharge 12 tons of bar iron at Paducah, as well as some flour and sugar and books, and there was supposed to be some 40 or 50 tons of lumber waiting there to be loaded. Paducah was a big lumbering town, with log rafts all the time coming down the Tennessee, clogging up the river and getting in the way of the steamboats. Like most steamboatmen, Marsh didn't have much use for rafters. Half the time, they didn't show no lights at night, and they got run over by some unlucky steamer, and then they had the gumption to cuss and yell and throw things. Fortunately, there were no rafts about when they put into Paducah and tied up. Marsh took one look at the cargo waiting on the riverfront, which included several towering stacks of crates and some bales of tobacco, and decided that it would be easy to get some more freight onto the main deck. It would be a shame, he decided, to steam away from Paducah and leave all this custom to some other boat. Already the Fever Dream was secure to the wharf, and swarms of roustabouts were laying down planks and starting to unload. Harry Mike moved out among them, yelling, "Quick now, you ain't no cabin passenger out for no stroll," and, "You drop that boy and I'm going to drop this here iron right alongside your head," and other such things. The stage came down with a whunk, and a few Paducah passengers began to disembark. Marsh made up his mind. He went to the clerk's office, where he found Jonathan Jeffers working over some bills of lading. "You got to do those now, Mr. Jeffers?" he asked. "Hardly, Captain Marsh," Jeffers replied. He removed his spectacles and wiped them on a neckerchief. "These are for Cairo." "Good," Marsh said. "Come on with me. Going to go ashore and find out who owns all that freight setting out there in the sun and where it's bound to. Figure it's got to be going St. Louis way, some of it, and maybe we can make ourselves some money." "Excellent," Jeffers replied. He got off his stool, straightened his neat black coat, checked to make sure the big iron safe was locked, and picked up his sword cane. "I know a fine grog shop in Paducah," he added as they left. Marsh's venture proved well worthwhile. They found the tobacco shipper easily enough, and took him to the grog shop, where Marsh persuaded him to consign his goods to the Fever Dream, and Jeffers dickered out a good price. It took some 3 hours, but Marsh was feeling damned pleased with the bit of work when he and Jeffers came strolling back to the riverfront and the Fever Dream. Harry Mike was lounging on the wharf, smoking a black cigar and talking with the mate from some other boat when they returned. "That's ours now," Marsh told him, pointing out the tobacco with his stick. "Get your boys to load it quick so we can get underway." Marsh leaned on the railing of the boiler deck, shaded and content, watching them scramble and tote the bales while Whitey got the steam up. He chanced to notice something else, a line of horse-drawn hotel omnibuses waiting on the road just off the steamboat landing. Marsh stared at them curiously for a moment, pulling at his whiskers, then went on up to the pilot house. The pilot was having a slice of pie and a cup of coffee. "Mr. Kitch," Marsh told him, "don't take her out until I tell you so." "Why is that, Captain? She's almost loaded and the steam's up." "Look out there," Marsh said, lifting his stick. "Them omnibuses are bringing passengers to the landing, or waiting for 'em to arrive. Not our passengers, neither. And they don't meet every little stern-wheeler that puts in. I got myself a hunch." A few moments later, his hunch was rewarded. Spewing steam and smoke and sparkling down the Ohio fast as the devil, a long, classy side-wheeler came into sight. Marsh recognized her almost at once. Even before he could read her name, the Southerner of the Cincinnati and Louisville Packet Company.
"I knew it," he said.
"She must have left Louisville a half day after we did. She made better time, though." He moved to the side window, brushed aside the fancy curtains that were shutting out the hot afternoon sun, and watched the other steamer pull in, tie up, and begin to discharge passengers. "She won't take long," Marsh said to his pilot. "No freight to load or unload, just passengers. You let her pull out first, you understand? Let her get down the river a bit, then you back out and go after her."
The pilot finished his last forkful of pie and wiped a bit of meringue from the corner of his mouth with his napkin.
"You want me to let the Southerner get ahead of us and then try to catch her? Captain will be breathing her steam all the way to Cairo. After that, she'll be out of sight."
Abner Marsh clouded up like a thunderhead about to break. "What do you think you're saying, Mr. Kitch? I don't want to listen to no talk like that. If you ain't pilot enough to do it, just say so, and I'll kick Mr. Daly out of bed and get him on up here to take the wheel."
"That's the Southerner," Kitch insisted.
"And this is the Fever Dream, and don't you forget it," Marsh shouted. He turned and stormed from the cabin, scowling. Damn pilots all thought they were kings of the river. Of course they were, once the boat was on the river, but that didn't give them no cause to go bellyaching about a little race and doubting his steamer. His fury faded when he saw that the Southerner was taking on passengers already. He had been hoping for something like this from the minute he spied the Southerner across the river back in Louisville, but he hadn't dared hope too hard. If Fever Dream could catch the Southerner, her reputation was halfway made, once folks along the river heard about it. The other steamer and her sister boat, the Northerner, were the pride of their line. They were special boats, built back in 53, especially for speed. Smaller than the Fever Dream, they were the only steamers Marsh knew of that didn't carry freight, only passengers. He couldn't see for a minute how they turned a profit, but that wasn't important. What was important was how fast they were. The Northerner had set a new record for the Louisville-St. Louis run back in 54. The Southerner broke it the following year, and still had the fastest time. 1 day and 19 hours even. High up on her pilot house, she wore the gilded antlers that marked her as the fleetest steamer on the Ohio. The more he considered the prospect of taking her on, the more excited Abner Marsh grew. All of a sudden it occurred to him that this was not something Joshua would care to miss, beauty sleep or no. Marsh stomped forward to York's cabin, determined to rouse him out. He rapped sharply on the door with the head of his walking stick. No answer. Marsh rapped again, louder and more insistently. "Hello in there," he boomed. "Get yourself out of bed, Joshua. We're going to run us a race." Still no sound came from within York's cabin. Marsh tried the door and found it locked. He rattled it, pounded on the walls, knocked on the shuttered window, shouted. All to no avail. "Damn you, York," he said. "Get yourself up or you're going to miss it." Then he had an idea. He walked back near the pilot house. "Mr. Kitch, sir," he shouted up. Abner Marsh could shout with the best of them when he put his lungs into it good. Kitch popped his head out the door and looked down at him. "You blow that whistle," Marsh told him, "and keep blowing it till I wave at you, you hear?" He returned to York's locked door and began pounding again, and suddenly the steam whistle began to shriek. Once, twice, three times. Long, angry blasts. Marsh flailed away with his stick. York's cabin door came open. Marsh took one look at York's eyes, and his mouth hung open in mid-shout. The steam whistle sounded again, and he waved hurriedly. It fell silent.
"Get in here,"
Joshua York said in a cold whisper. Marsh entered, and York swung the door shut behind him. Marsh heard him throw the lock. He didn't see it. He didn't see anything. Once the door closed, York's cabin was black as the pit. Not even a crack of light snuck in through the door or the shuttered, curtained windows. Marsh felt like he'd gone blind. But in his mind's eye, a vision lingered, the last thing he'd seen before the darkness closed in. Joshua York,
Standing in the doorway, naked as the day he was born, his skin deathly white as alabaster, his lips drawn back in animal rage, his eyes like two smoky gray slits opening onto hell.
"Joshua," Marsh said, "can you turn on a lamp? Or pull back a curtain or something? I can't see."
"I can see just fine," York's voice replied from the darkness behind him. Marsh hadn't heard him move. He turned and blundered into something.
"Hold still,"
York commanded, with such force and fury in his tone that Marsh had no choice but to obey.
"Here, I'll give you a light before you wreck my cabin."
A match flared across the room, and York touched it to his reading candle, then seated himself on the edge of his rumpled bed. He donned a pair of trousers somehow, but his face was hard and terrible.
"There," he said. "Now, why are you here? I warn you, you had better have a reason."
Marsh began to grow angry. No one talked to him that way, no one.
"The Southerner is next to us, York," he snapped. "The fastest damn boat on this river. Got the horns and everything. I'm fixing to run Fever Dream after her, and I thought you'd want to see. If you don't think that's reason enough for getting you out of bed, then you ain't no steamboatman, and you never will be. And you watch your manners with me, you hear?"
Something flared in Joshua York's eyes, and he started to rise, but even as he did, he checked himself and turned away.
"Abner," he said.
He paused, frowning.
"I am sorry. I did not intend to treat you with disrespect or to frighten you. Your intent was good."
Marsh was startled to see his hand clench violently before he steadied it. York crossed the dim cabin with three quick, purposeful strides. On his desk rested the bottle of his private drink, the one Marsh had caused him to open the night before. He poured out a full goblet of it, tossed back his head, and drained it straight away.
"Ah," he said softly.
He swung about to face Marsh again.
"Abner," he said,
"I've given you your dream boat, but not as a gift. We struck a bargain. You are to obey such orders as I give, respect my eccentric behavior, and ask no questions. Do you mean to live up to your half of our bargain?"
"I am a man of my word," Marsh said stoutly.
"Good," said York.
"Now listen. You meant well, but it was wrong of you to wake me as you did. Never do it again. Never. For any reason. If the boiler blows and we catch fire, I'm to let you crisp in here, is that it?"
York's eyes glittered in the half-light.
"No," he admitted.
"But it might be safer for you if you did.
I am unruly when woken suddenly. I am not myself. I have been known at such times to do things I later regret. That was why I was so short with you. I apologize for it. But it would happen again, or worse. Do you understand, Abner? Never come in here when my door is locked."
Marsh frowned, but he could think of nothing to say. He had struck the bargain, after all. If York wanted to get all upset about a little sleep, it was his business.
"I understand," he said. "Your apology is accepted, and you got mine, if it matters. Now, do you want to come up and watch us take the Southerner? Seeing as how you're woke already and all?" "No," said York, grim-faced.
"It is not that I have no interest, Abner. I do. But you must understand, I need my rest, vitally. And I do not care for daylight. The sun is harsh, burning. Have you ever had a bad burn? If so, you can understand. You've seen how fair I am. The sun and I do not agree. It is a medical condition, Abner. I do not care to discuss it further."
"All right," Marsh said.
Beneath his feet, the deck began to vibrate slightly. The steam whistle sounded its ear-piercing wail.
"We're backing out," Marsh said. "I got to go. Joshua, I'm sorry to have bothered you. Truly, I am."
York nodded, turned away, and began to pour himself more of his noxious drink.
"I know."
He sipped at it this time.
"Go," he said. "I will see you this evening at supper." Marsh moved toward the door, but York's voice stopped him before he could open it. Abner. Yes, Marsh said. Joshua York favored him with a pale, thin smile. Beat her, Abner. Win. Marsh grinned and left the cabin. When he reached the pilot house, the Fever Dream had backed clear of the landing and was reversing her paddles. The Southerner was already well down the river. The pilot house was crowded with a good half dozen off-duty pilots, talking and chewing tobacco and making side wagers on whether or not they'd catch the other boat. Even Mr. Daly had interrupted his leisure to come up and observe. The passengers all knew something was afoot. The lower decks were crowded as they sat along the railings and pushed onto the forecastle for a good view. Kitch swung the great black and silver wheel, and the Fever Dream angled out toward the main channel, sliding into the brisk current behind her rival. He called down for more steam. Whitey threw some pitch in the furnace, and they gave the folks on shore a show, puffing out great clouds of dense black smoke as they steamed away. Abner Marsh stood behind the pilot, leaning on his stick and squinting. The afternoon sun shone on the clear blue water ahead of them, leaving blinding reflections that danced and shimmered and hurt the eyes, except where the churning wake of the Southerners' paddle wheels had cut them all up into a thousand fiery pieces. For a few moments it looked easy. The Fever Dream surged forward, steam and smoke flying from her, American flags fore and aft flapping like the devil, her wheels slapping against the water in an ever-faster tempo, engines rumbling below. The gap between her and the other steamer began to diminish visibly. But the Southerner was no Mary Kay, no two-bit stern-wheeler to be left behind at will. It wasn't long before her captain or her pilot realized what was going on, and her reply was a taunting lurch of speed. Her smoke thickened and came streaming back at them, and her wake grew even more violent and choppy. So Kitch had to swing the Fever Dream wide a bit to avoid it, losing part of the current as he did. The distance between them widened again, then held steady. "Keep after her," Marsh told his pilot after it was clear that the two steamers were holding their positions. He left the pilot house and went searching for Harry Mike Dunn, who he finally located on the forecastle of the main deck, with his boots up on a crate and a big cigar in his mouth. "Round up the rusters and deckhands," Marsh said to the mate. "I want 'em to trim boat." Harry Mike nodded, rose, ground out his smoke, and started bellowing. In a few moments, most of the crew could be found aft and larboard. To partially offset the weight of the passengers, the majority of whom were crowded up forward and starboard to watch the race. "Damn passengers," Marsh muttered. The Fever Dream, now slightly better balanced, began to creep up on the Southerner once more. Marsh returned to the pilot house. Both boats were going at it hard now, and they were pretty well matched. Abner Marsh figured the Fever Dream was more powerful, but it wasn't enough. She was heavily laden with freight and running low in the water, and in the Southerner's wake to boot. So the waves kicked up over her head a bit and slowed her, while the Southerner skipped along easy as you please, with nothing aboard but passengers and nothing ahead but a clear river. Now, barring breakdowns or accidents, it was up to the pilots. Kitch was intent at the wheel, handling her easy, doing his damnedest to pick up a few minutes at every chance. Behind him, Daly and the vagabond pilots were babbling away, full of advice on the river and its stage and how best to run it. For more than an hour, the Fever Dream chased the Southerner, losing sight of her once or twice around bends, but edging closer each time as Kitch shaved it tight coming around. Once they got close enough so Marsh could make out the faces of the passengers leaning on the other boat's aft railings, but then the Southerner kicked forward again and restored the distance between them. "Bet you they just changed pilots," Kitch said, spitting a wad of tobacco juice into a nearby cuspidor. "See the way she perked up there?" "I seen," Marsh growled. "Now I want to see us perk up a mite, too." Then they got their break. One moment the Southerner was holding steady in front of them, sweeping around a densely wooded bend. Then all of a sudden her whistle started to hooting, and she slowed and trembled, and her side wheels started to back. "Careful!" Daly said to Kitch. Kitch spat again and moved the wheel careful-like, and the Fever Dream nosed across the turbulent wake of the Southerner to go wide and starboard of her. When they were halfway round the bend, they saw the cause of the trouble. Another big steamer, main deck all but buried beneath bales of tobacco, had run aground on a sandbar. Her mate and crew were out with spars and winches, trying to grasshopper her over. The Southerner had almost run right into them. For a long few minutes, the river was chaotic. The men on the bar were all shouting and waving. The Southerner backed like the devil. The Fever Dream steamed toward clear water. Then the Southerner reversed her wheels again, and her head turned, and it looked as though she was trying to cross right in front of the Fever Dream. "Damn egg-sucking idiot," Kitch said, and he swung the wheel a little more and told Whitey to ease up on the larboard. But he didn't back or try to stop her. The two big steamers edged toward each other, closer and closer. Marsh could hear passengers crying out an alarm down below, and there was a second or two when even he thought they were going to collide. But then the Southerner eased off herself, and her pilot swung her bow downstream again, and the Fever Dream nosed by her with feet to spare. Someone began to cheer below. "Keep her going," Marsh muttered so low that no one could have heard him. The Southerner had her wheels kicking up spray and was hot after them, behind now, but not by much, running a bare boat's length astern. All the damn passengers on the Fever Dream rushed aft, of course, and all the crew had to rush forward, so the steamer shook to all the running footsteps. The Southerner was gaining on them again. She was running to their larboard, parallel and just behind. Her bow came up to the Fever Dream's stern now, and she was creeping up inch by inch. The sides of the two steamers were close enough so that the passengers could have jumped from one to the other if they'd had a mind to, though the Fever Dream stood taller. "Damn," said Marsh, when the other boat drew almost abreast of them. "Enough is enough. Kitch, call down and tell Whitey to use my lard." The pilot glanced his way, grinning ear to ear. "Lard, Captain? Oh, I knew you was a sly one." He barked a command down the speaking tube to the engine room. The two steamers were running head to head. Marsh's grip on his stick was all sweat. Down below, probably, the deckhands were arguing with some damn foreigners who'd gone and perched on those lard barrels and had to be dislodged before the lard could be dragged off to the stokers. Marsh was burning with impatience, hot as his lard would be. Good lard was expensive, but it came in handy on a steamer. The cook could use it, and it burned damn hot, and that was what they needed now. A good hot head of high-pressure steam they couldn't get from wood alone. When the lard got chucked in, there was no doubt in the pilot house. Long, high columns of white steam came a-hissing up out of the escape pipes, and smoke rolled from the high chimneys, and the Fever Dream snorted fire and shook just a mite. And then she was sparkling. Chunka, chunka, chunka. Fast as a train wheel, the stroke pounding the deck. She went flying right on out ahead of the Southerner, and when she was safely clear of her, Kitch eased her right in front of the other steamer's bow, leaving them to ride her waves. All those worthless, birthless pilots were chuckling and passing around smokes and yapping about what a heller of a boat this Fever Dream was, while the Southerner receded behind them, and Abner Marsh grinned like a fool. They were a full 10 minutes ahead of the Southerner when they put into Cairo, where the broad Ohio's clear waters merged with the muddy Mississippi. By then, Abner Marsh had almost forgot about that little incident with Joshua York. Chapter 6, Julian Plantation, Louisiana, July 1857. Sour Billy Tipton was out front chucking his knife at the big dead tree that fronted the gravel path when the riders approached. It was morning, but already hot as hell, and Sour Billy was working himself up a good sweat and thinking of going down for a swim when he finished up his knife throwing. Then he saw the riders emerge from the woods, where the old road crooked around. He went over to the dead tree and pulled loose his knife and slid it back into its sheath behind his back, all thoughts of swimming forgotten. The riders came on real slow, but bold as brass, riding straight up in broad daylight like they belonged here, They couldn't be from these parts, so our Billy figured. What neighbors they had all knew that Damon Julian didn't like no one coming onto his land without his leave. When they were still too far away to make out good, he wondered if maybe they weren't some of Montree's Creole friends come to make trouble. If so, they were going to regret it. Then he saw why they were riding so slow, and Sour Billy relaxed. Two niggers in chains were stumbling along behind the two men on horseback. He crossed his arms and leaned against the tree, waiting for them to reach him. Sure enough, they reined up. One of the men on horseback looked at the house with its peeling paint and half-rotted front steps, spat out a wad of tobacco juice, and turned to Sour Billy. "This the Julian plantation?" he said. He was a big red-faced man with a wart on his nose, dressed in smelly leathers and a slouchy felt hat. "Sure is," Sour Billy replied. But he was looking past the horseman and his companion, a lean, pink-cheeked youth who was probably the other's son. He went walking over to the two haggard-looking niggers, downcast and miserable in their chains, and Sour Billy smiled. "Why," he said, "if it ain't Lily and Sam. Never thought you two be dropping by again. Must be 2 years since you went and run off. Mr. Julian will be real pleased to know that you come back." Sam, a big, powerful-looking buck, raised his head and stared at Sour Billy, but there was no defiance in his eyes, only fear. "We come on him up to Arkansas, my boy and me," the red-faced man said. "Tried to claim they was free niggers, but they didn't fool me for a minute, no sir." Sour Billy looked at the slave catchers and nodded. "Go on." "They was awful stubborn, these two. Couldn't get 'em to tell us where they was from for the longest while. Whipped 'em right smart. Used a few other tricks, I know. Usually with niggers, you just scares 'em a bit and it pops right out. Not with these." He spat. "Well, we finally got it out of 'em. Show him, Jim." The boy dismounted, went over to the woman, and lifted her right arm. Three fingers were missing from her hand. One of the stumps was still crusted over with a scab. "We started with the right, 'cause we noticed she was left-handed," the man said. "Didn't want to cripple her up too bad, you understand. But we couldn't find nothing in the papers, no posters out neither, so..." He shrugged eloquently. "Got to the third finger, like you see. And the man finally told us. The woman cussed him out something fierce." He guffawed. "Anyway, here they is. Two slaves like that got to be worth something to us for catching them. This Mr. Julian at home?" "No," said Sour Billy, looking up at the sun. It was still a couple of hours shy of noon. "Well," said the red-faced man, "you must be the overseer, right? The one they call Sour Billy?" "That's me," he said. "Sam and Lily talk about me?" The slave catcher laughed again. "Oh, they did a powerful lot of talking, once we knew where they come from. Talked all the way here. We shut 'em up a time or two, my boy and me, but then they'd just start to talking again. Some stories, too." Sour Billy looked at the two runaways with his cold, malicious eyes, but neither one would meet his gaze. "Maybe you can just take charge of these two and give us our reward, and we'll be riding on our way," the man said. "No," said Sour Billy Tipton. "You got to wait. Mr. Julian will want to give you his thanks personal. Won't be too long. He'll be back by dark." "By dark, eh?" the man said. He and his son exchanged glances. "Funny, Mr. Sour Billy, but these here niggers said you'd say just that very thing. They tell queer stories about what goes on here after dark. My boy and I, we just sooner take our money and leave if it's all the same to you." "It won't be all the same to Mr. Julian," Sour Billy said. "And I can't give you no money, neither. You're going to believe some fool story told you by a couple niggers?" The man frowned, working his tobacco all the while. "Nigger stories is one thing," he said finally. "But I knowed niggers to tell the truth once in a while, too. Now, what we'll do, Mr. Sour Billy, is wait, like you say, for this Mr. Julian to come home. But don't you think we're going to let ourselves be cheated?
He had a pistol by his side. He patted it.
I'm going to wear my friend here whiles I wait. And my boy, he's got one too. And we're both of us handy with our knives. You understand? These niggers learned us all about that little knife you got hid behind your back, so don't you go a-reaching back there like to scratch or anything, or else our fingers might get a little bit itchy, too. Let's just all of us wait and be friends. Sour Billy turned his eyes on the slave catcher and gave him a cold stare, but the big man was too stupid to even notice. We'll wait inside, Sour Billy said, keeping his hands well clear of his back. Just fine, the slave catcher said. He dismounted. My name is Tom Johnston, by the way, and that's my boy Jim. Mr. Julian will be pleased to meet you, Sour Billy said. Tie up your horses and bring the niggers on inside. Careful on the steps, they's rotted through in places. The woman started to whimper as they led her toward the house, but Jim Johnston gave her a smart crack across the mouth, and she fell silent again. Sour Billy led them to the library and drew back the heavy curtains to admit some light into the dim, dusty room. The slaves sat on the floor while the two catchers stretched out in the heavy leather chairs. Now, said Tom Johnston, this here is real nice. Everything is all rotten and dusty, Daddy, the youth said, just like them niggers said it'd be. Well, well, said Sour Billy, looking at the two niggers. Well, well. Mr. Julian ain't going to be pleased you've been spreading tales about his house. You two earned yourself a whipping. The big black buck Sam found the courage to raise his head and glower. I ain't scared of no whipping. Sour Billy smiled just slightly. Why, then, there's worse things than whipping, Sam. Indeed, there is. That was too much for the woman, Lily. She looked at the youth. He's telling the truth, Master Jim, he is. You gotta listen. Take us out of here for dark. You and your daddy can own us, work us. We work real hard for you, we will. Won't run away. We're good niggers. Never would have run away, but for... Don't wait till dark, Master, don't. It'll be too late then. The boy hit her hard with the butt of his pistol, leaving a welt across her cheek and knocking her backward to the carpet where she lay, shuddering and weeping. Shut your lying black mouth, he said. You want a drink? Sour Billy asked him. The hours passed. They went through most of two bottles of Julian's best brandy, swilling it down like it was cheap whiskey. They ate. They talked. Sour Billy didn't do much talking himself, just asked questions to draw out Tom Johnston, who was drunk and vain and in love with his own voice. The slave catchers operated out of Napoleon, Arkansas, it seemed, but they weren't there much, traveling like they did. There was a Mrs. Johnston, but she stayed at home with her daughter. They didn't tell her much of their business. Woman ain't got no reason to know about her man's comings and goings. You tell them something or other, just you don't see if they don't go and bother you about it if you're late. Then you gotta slap them around, he spat. Easier just to keep them guessing, so they's grateful when you shows up. Johnston left Sour Billy with the impression that he preferred topping nigger wenches anyway, so his wife was no loss to him. Outside, the sun was sinking toward the west. When the shadows lay thick across the room, Sour Billy rose and drew the curtains and lit some candles. I'll go and get Mr. Julian, he said. The younger Johnston looked awful pale as he turned to his father, Sour Billy thought. Daddy, I didn't hear no one ride up, he said. Wait, said Sour Billy Tipton. He left them, walked through the darkened, deserted ballroom, and climbed the grand staircase. Upstairs, he entered a large bedroom, the wide French windows boarded up, the ornate bed shrouded by a black velvet canopy. Mr. Julian, he called softly from the door. The room was black and stifling. Behind the canopy, something stirred. The velvet hangings were pushed back. Damon Julian emerged, pale, quiet, cold. His black eyes seemed to reach right out of the darkness and touch Sour Billy. Yes, Billy? Came the soft voice. Sour Billy told him everything. Damon Julian smiled. Bring them into the dining room. I'll join you in a few moments. The dining room had a great old chandelier, but it had not been lit in Sour Billy's memory. After bringing in the slave catchers, he found some matches and touched off a small oil lamp, which he set on the middle of his long table, so it threw a small ring of light on the white linen tablecloth, but left the rest of the narrow, high-ceilinged room in shadow. The Johnstons took seats, the younger one peering around uneasily, his hand never leaving his pistol. The niggers held each other miserably at one end of the table. "Where's this Julian?" Tom Johnston growled. "Soon, Tom," said Sour Billy. "Wait." For nearly 10 minutes, no one spoke. Then Jim Johnston sucked in his breath. "Daddy," he said, "look, somebody's standing in that door." The door led to the kitchen. It was black back there. Full night had fallen, and the only illumination in this part of the house was the oil lamp on the table. Beyond the kitchen door, nothing could be seen but vague, threatening shadows, and something that looked like the outline of a human form standing very still. Lily whimpered, and the nigger Sam held her more closely. Tom Johnston got to his feet, his chair scraping over the wooden floor, his face hard. He drew and cocked his pistol. "Who's that?" he demanded. "Come out!" "No need to be alarmed," said Damon Julian. They all turned, Johnston jumping like he'd been spooked. Julian stood beneath the archway to the foyer, framed against darkness, smiling charmingly, dressed in a long dark suit with a red silk tie shining at his neck. His eyes were dark and amused, the flame of the lamp reflected in them. "That's only Valerie," Julian said. With a rustle of her skirts, she emerged and stood in the kitchen door, pale and quiet, yet still strikingly beautiful. Johnston looked at her and laughed. "Ah," he said, "only a woman. Sorry, Mr. Julian. Them nigger stories got me all jumpy." "I understand perfectly," said Damon Julian.
"There's others behind him,"
Jim Johnston whispered. They all saw them now, dim figures, indistinct, lost in the darkness at Julian's back. "Only my friends," said Damon Julian, smiling. A woman in a light blue gown emerged at his right. "Cynthia," he said. Another woman in green stood to his left. "Adrienne," Julian added. He raised his arm in a weary, languid gesture. "And that is Raymond and Jean and Kurt." They emerged together, moving silent as cats from other doors, ringing the long room. "And behind you are Elaine and George and Vincent." Johnston whirled, and there they were, stepping out from the shadows. Still more came into view behind Julian himself. Except for the whisperings of cloth against cloth, none of them made any sound as they moved, and they all stared and smiled invitingly. Sour Billy wasn't smiling, though he was vastly amused at the way Tom Johnston clutched his gun and cast his eyes about like a frightened animal. "Mr. Julian," he said, "I ought to tell you that Mr. Johnston here don't intend to be cheated. He's got him a gun, Mr. Julian, and his boy, too, and they're both handy with their knives." "Ah," said Damon Julian. The niggers began to pray. Young Jim Johnston looked at Damon Julian and drew his own pistol. "We brung you your niggers," he said. "We won't bother you for no reward, neither. We'll just be going."
"Going?"
Julian said. "Now, would I let you leave without a reward? When you've come all the way from Arkansas, thus to bring us a few darkies? I wouldn't hear of it." He crossed the room. Jim Johnston, caught in those dark eyes of his, held his pistol up and did not move. Julian took it from his hand and laid it on the table. He touched the youth's cheek. "Beneath the dirt, you're a handsome boy," he said. "What are you doing to my boy?" Tom Johnston demanded.
"Get away from him."
He flourished his pistol. Damon Julian glanced around. "Your boy has a certain rude beauty," he said. "You, on the other hand, have a wart
He is a wart, Sour Billy Tipton suggested. Tom Johnston glared, and Damon Julian smiled. Indeed, he said. Amusing, Billy. Julian gestured to Valerie and Adrienne. They glided toward him, and each took young Jim Johnston by the arm. You want help? Sour Billy offered. No, said Julian. Thank you. With a graceful, almost offhand gesture, he raised his hand and brought it lightly across the youth's long neck. Jim Johnston made a wet, choking sound. A thin line of red suddenly appeared across his throat, a little looping scarlet necklace, whose bright red beads swelled larger and larger as they watched, bursting one by one to send trickles down his neck. Jim Johnston began to thrash, but the iron embrace of the two pale women held him immobile. Damon Julian leaned forward and pressed his open mouth to the flow to catch the hot, bright blood. Tom Johnston made an incoherent animal noise deep in his chest and took the longest time to react. Finally, he cocked his pistol again and took aim. Elaine stepped in his path, and suddenly Vincent and Jean were beside him, and Raymond and Cynthia touched him from behind with cold white hands. Johnston cursed at them and fired. There was a flash and a whiff of acrid smoke, and weed-thin Elaine staggered back and fell, driven by the force of the bullet. A flow of dark blood seeped through the white ruffled shirt front he wore. Half sprawled, half seated, Elaine touched his chest and his hand came away bloody. Raymond and Cynthia had Johnston firmly by then, and Jean took the gun from his hand with a smooth, easy motion. The big, red-faced man did not resist. He was staring at Elaine. The flow of blood had stopped. Elaine smiled, showing long white teeth, terrible and sharp. He rose and came on. No! Screamed Johnston. No, I shot you! You gotta be dead, I shot you! Niggers sometimes tell the truth, Mr. Johnston, said Sour Billy Tipton. All the truth. You should have listened. Raymond reached under Johnston's slouchy hat and got a good grip on his hair, jerking his head back to expose his thick red neck. Elaine laughed and tore Johnston's throat out with his teeth. Then the others closed in. Sour Billy Tipton reached back and pulled his knife and sauntered over to the two niggers. Come on, he said. Mr. Julian don't need you tonight. But you two ain't going to be running off no more. Down to the cellar. Come on, be quick about it, or I'll leave you here with them. That got them moving right proper, as Sour Billy knew it would. The cellar was small and dank. You had to go through a trap door under a rug to get to it. The land around here was too wet for a proper cellar, but this cellar wasn't proper. 2 inches of standing water covered the floor. The ceiling was so low a man couldn't stand upright, and the walls were green with mold. Sour Billy chained the niggers up good, close enough so that they could touch. He figured that was real nice of him. He brought them a hot dinner, too. Afterward, he made his own dinner and washed it down with what was left of the second bottle of brandy the Johnstons had opened. He was just finishing up when Elaine came into the kitchen. The blood had dried on his shirt, and there was a burnt black hole where the shot had gone through, but otherwise he looked none the worse for wear. It's finished, Elaine told him. Julian wants you in the library. Sour Billy pushed away his plate and went to answer the summons. The dining room badly wanted cleaning, he noted when he passed through. Adrienne and Kurt and Armand were enjoying some wine amid the dim silence there. The bodies, or what was left of them, just feet away. Some of the others were off in the drawing room talking. The library was pitch dark. Sour Billy had expected to find Damon Julian alone. But when he entered, he saw three indistinct figures in the shadows, two seated, one standing. He couldn't make out who they were. He waited in the door until Julian finally spoke. In the future, do not ever bring such people into my library, the voice said. They were filthy. They left a smell. Sour Billy felt a brief stab of fear. Yes, sir, he said, facing the chair from which Julian had spoken. I'm sorry, Mr. Julian. After a moment of silence, Julian said, Close the door, Billy. Come in. You may use the lamp. The lamp was made of showy red-stained glass. Its flame gave the dusty room the red-brown cast of dried blood. Damon Julian sat in a high-backed chair, his fine long fingers steepled beneath his chin, a faint smile on his face. Valerie sat at his right hand. The sleeve of her gown had gotten torn in the struggles, but she didn't seem to have noticed. Sourbilly thought she was even paler than usual. A few feet away, Jean stood behind another chair, looking guarded and nervous, twisting a big gold ring on his finger.
"Must he be here?"
Valerie asked Julian. She glanced at Billy briefly, contempt in her big purple eyes.
"Why, Valerie?"
Julian replied. He reached out and took her hand. She trembled and pressed her lips together tightly.
"I brought Billy to reassure you," Julian continued.
Jean gathered up his courage and stared right at Sourbilly, frowning. "This Johnston had a wife." "So that was it," Sourbilly thought. "You scared?" he asked Jean mockingly. Jean was not one of Julian's favorites, though it was safe to taunt him.
"He had a wife," Billy said, "but it ain't nothing to worry over. He never talked to her much, never told her where he was going or when he'd be back. She ain't going to be coming after you."
"I do not like it, Damon," Jean grumbled.
"What about the slaves?" Valerie demanded. "They've been gone 2 years. They said things to the Johnstons, dangerous things. They must have talked to others as well."
"Billy?" Julian said. Sourbilly shrugged. "I expect they told stories to every damn nigger between here and Arkansas," he said. "It don't worry me none. Just a pack of nigger stories. Ain't nobody going to believe it."
"I wonder," said Valerie. She turned to Damon Julian, pleading.
"Damon, please. Jean is right. We have been here too long. It is not safe.
Remember what they did to that LaLaurie woman in New Orleans, the one who tortured her slaves for pleasure? The talk finally caught up with her. And what she did was nothing to..."
She hesitated, swallowed, and added quietly,
"to the things we do, the things we must do."
She turned her face away from Julian. Slowly, gently, Julian reached out a pale hand, touched her cheek, drew a finger down the side of her face in a tender caress, then caught her under the chin and made her look at him.
"Are you so timid now, Valerie? Must I remind of who you are? Have you been listening to Jean again? Is he the master now? Is he Bloodmaster?"
"No,"
she said, her deep violet eyes wider than ever, her voice afraid.
"No."
"Who is the Bloodmaster, dear Valerie?" Julian asked. His eyes were lambent and heavy and bored right into her.
"You are, Damon," she whispered. "You."
"Look at me, Valerie. Do you think I need fear any tales told by a pack of slaves? What do I care what they say of me?"
Valerie opened her mouth. No words came out. Satisfied, Damon Julian released his hold on her. There were deep red marks on her flesh where his fingers had pressed. He smiled at Sourbilly as Valerie threw back.
"What do you think, Billy?"
Sourbilly Tipton looked down at his feet and shuffled nervously. He knew what he ought to say, but he'd been doing some figuring lately, and there were things he had to tell Julian that Julian wouldn't take kindly to hearing. He'd been putting it off, but now he didn't see as how he had any more choice.
"I don't know, Mr. Julian," he said weakly.
"You don't know, Billy? What is it you don't know?" The tone was cold and vaguely threatening. Sourbilly plunged on regardless.
"I don't know how long we can go on, Mr. Julian," he said boldly. "I've been thinking on this some, and there's things I don't like. This here plantation brought in a lot of money when Garou was running it, but it's near worthless now. You know I can get work out of any slave, damned if I can. But them what's dead or run off, I can't work. When you and your friend started taking kids from them shanties, or ordering the likely wenches up to the big house where they never come out, that was the start of our troubles. You ain't had no slaves for more than a year now,
excepting those fancy girls, and they sure don't stay around long. He laughed nervously. We don't got no crops. We sold half the plantation, all the best parcels of land. And them fancy girls, Mr. Julian, they're expensive. We got us bad money troubles. And that ain't all. Doing in niggers is one thing, but using white folks for the thirst, that's dangerous. In New Orleans, well, maybe that's safe enough. But you and I know it was Kara killed Henri Casson's youngest boy. He's a neighbor, Mr. Julian. They all know there's something peculiar over here anyway. If their slaves and children start to dying, we're going to have us real trouble. Trouble? Said Damon Julian. We are almost 20 strong with you. What can the cattle do to us? Mr. Julian, said Sourbilly, what if they come by day? Julian waved a hand casually. It will not happen. If it does, we will deal with them as they deserve. Sourbilly grimaced. Julian might be unconcerned, but it was Sourbilly took the biggest risks. I think maybe she's right, Mr. Julian, he said unhappily. I think we ought to go somewheres. We've drained this place. It's dangerous to stay on. I am comfortable here, Billy, Julian said. I feed on the cattle. I do not run from them. Money, then. Where are we going to get money? Our guests left horses. Take them to New Orleans tomorrow. Sell them. See that they aren't traced. You may sell off more of the land as well. Neville of Bayou Cross will want to buy again. Call on him, Billy. Julian smiled. You might even invite him to dinner here to discuss my proposition. Ask him to bring along his lovely wife and that lithe young son of theirs. Sam and Lily can serve. It will be just as it used to be before the slaves ran off. He was taunting, Sourbilly thought, but it was never safe to treat any of Julian's words lightly. The house, Billy said. They'll come to eat and they'll see how far it's gone. Isn't safe. They'll tell stories when they go home. If they go home, Billy.
Damon, Jean said shakily. You can't mean...
The dim, red-drenched room was hot. Sourbilly had begun to sweat. Neville is... Please, Mr. Julian, you can't take Neville. You can't go on taking folks from around here and buying fancy girls.
Your creature is right for once,
Valerie said in a very small voice.
Listen to him.
Jean was nodding too, emboldened by having others on his side. We could sell the whole place, Billy said. It's all rotted out anyhow. Move to New Orleans, all of us. It'd be better down there. With all them Creoles and free niggers and river trash, a few more or less wouldn't be missed, you know. No, said Damon Julian, icily. His voice told them he would stand no further argument. Sourbilly shut up real quick. Jean began to toy with his ring again, his mouth sullen and afraid. But Valerie astoundingly spoke up.
Let us go, then.
Julian turned his head languidly.
Us? Jean and I, she said. Send us away. It will be better that way. For you, too. It's safer when there are fewer of us. Your fancy girls will last longer.
Send you away, dear Valerie? Why, I would miss you. And I would be concerned for you, too. Where would you go, I wonder?
Somewhere. Anywhere.
Do you still hope to find your dark city in a cave? Julian said mockingly. Your faith is touching, child. Have you mistaken poor weak Jean for your pale king?
No, said Valerie. No. We only want a rest.
Please, Damon.
If we all stay, they will find us out, hunt us, kill us. Let us go away.
You are so beautiful, Valerie. So exquisite.
Please, she said, trembling. Away. A rest.
Poor small Valerie, Julian said. There is no rest. Wherever you go, your thirst will travel with you. No, you shall stay.
Please,
she repeated numbly.
My blood master.
Damon Julian's dark eyes narrowed just slightly, and the smile faded. If you are that eager to be away, perhaps I should give you what you ask for. Both Valerie and Jean looked at him hopefully. Perhaps I should send you away, Julian mused. Both of you. But not together, no. You are so beautiful, Valerie. You deserve better than Jean. What do you think, Billy? Sour Billy smirked. Send them all away, Mr. Julian. You don't need them none. You got me. Send them off, and they'll see how much they like it. Interesting, said Damon Julian. I will think on it. Now leave me, all of you. Billy, go sell the horses. See Neville about the land. No dinner? Sour Billy asked with relief. No, said Julian. Sour Billy was the last to reach the door. Behind him, Julian snuffed the light, and darkness filled the room. But Sour Billy hesitated at the threshold and turned back again. Mr. Julian, he said, your promise. It's been years now. When? When I do not need you, Billy. You are my eyes by day. You do the things I cannot. How could I spare you now? But have no fear, it will not be long. And time will seem as nothing to you when you join us. Years and days are alike to one who has the life eternal. The promise filled Sour Billy with reassurance. He left to do Julian's bidding. That night he dreamt. In his dreams he was as dark and graceful as Julian himself, elegant and predatory. It was always night in his dreams, and he roamed the streets of New Orleans beneath a full pale moon. They watched him pass from their windows and their little iron lace balconies, and he could feel their eyes upon him, the men full of fear, the women drawn to his dark power. Through the dark he stalked them, gliding soundlessly over the brick sidewalks, hearing their frantic footsteps and their panting. Beneath the swaying fire of a hanging oil lamp, he caught a fine young dandy and tore his throat out, laughing. A sultry Creole beauty watched him from afar. And he came after her, hunting her down alleys and courtyards as she ran before him. Finally, in a court lit by a wrought iron flambeau, she turned to face him. She looked a bit like Valerie. Her eyes were violet and full of fire. He came to her and pushed her back and took her. Creole blood was as hot and rich as Creole food. The night was his, and all the nights forever, and the red thirst was on him. When he woke from the dream, he was hot and fevered, and his sheets were wet. Chapter 7, St. Louis, July 1857. The fever dream lay up in St. Louis for 12 days. It was a busy time for the entire crew, but for Joshua York and his strange companions. Abner Marsh was up and about early every morning, and on the streets by 10, making calls on shippers and hotel proprietors, talking up his boat and trying to scare up business. He had a mess of handbills printed for Fever River packets, now that he had more than one packet again, and hired some boys to paste them up all over the city. Drinking and eating in all the best places, Marsh told and retold the story of how the fever dream took the Southerner, to make sure the word got around. He even took out advertisements in 3 of the local papers. The lightning pilots that Abner Marsh had hired for the lower river came aboard as soon as the fever dream put into St. Louis and drew their wages for the time they'd idled away waiting. Pilots didn't come cheap, especially pilots like these two, but Marsh didn't begrudge the money too much, since he wanted the best for his steamer. Once paid, the new men resumed their idling. Pilots drew full wages all the time, but didn't do a lick of work until the steamer was in the river. Anything besides piloting was beneath their dignity. The 2 pilots Marsh had found had their own individual styles of idling, though. Dan Albright, prim and taciturn and fashionable, strolled aboard the day the fever dream put in, surveyed the boat, the engines, and the pilot house, nodded with satisfaction, and immediately took up residence in his cabin. He spent his days reading in the steamer's well-stocked library and played a few games of chess with Jonathan Jeffers in the main saloon, although Jeffers invariably beat him. Carl Fram, on the other hand,
could usually be found in the billiard halls along the riverfront, grinning crookedly beneath his wide-brimmed felt hat and bragging about how him and his new boat were going to run everyone else off the river. Fram had a heller's reputation. He liked to joke about how he kept one wife in St. Louis, one in New Orleans, and a third in Natchez under the hill.
Abner Marsh didn't have the time to worry over much about what his pilots were doing. He was too busy with this task or that one. Nor did he see much of Joshua York and his friends, although he understood that York frequently went on long nightly walks into the city, often with Simon, the silent one. Simon was also learning how to mix drinks, since Joshua had told Marsh he had a mind to use him as night bartender on the run down to New Orleans. Marsh did frequently see his partner over supper, which Joshua York was in the habit of taking in the main cabin with the other officers before he retired to his own cabin or the library to read newspapers, packets of which were delivered to him every day, fresh off incoming steamers. Once York announced that he was going into the city to see a group of players perform, he invited Abner Marsh and the other officers to accompany him, but Marsh was having none of it, so York wound up going with Jonathan Jeffers. "Poems and plays," Marsh muttered to Harry Mike Dunn as they sauntered off. "It makes you wonder what this damn river is coming to." Afterward, Jeffers began to teach York to play chess. "He has quite a mind, Abner," Jeffers told Marsh a few days later, on the morning of their eighth day in St. Louis. "Who?" "Why, Joshua, of course. I taught him the moves 2 days ago. Last night I found him in the saloon playing over the score of one of Morphy's games from one of those New York newspapers he takes. A strange man. How much do you know about him?" Marsh frowned. He didn't want his people getting too curious about Joshua York. That was part of the bargain. "Joshua don't like to talk much about himself. I don't ask him. A man's past is none of my business, I figure. You ought to take the same attitude, Mr. Jeffers. In fact, see that you do." The clerk arched his thin, dark eyebrows. "If you say so, Captain," he replied. But there was a cool smile on his face that Abner Marsh found disquieting. Jeffers was not the only one to ask questions. Harry Mike came to Marsh, too, and said that the roustabouts and the stokers were spreading some funny talk about York and his four guests, and did Marsh want him to do anything about it? "What kind of talk?" Harry Mike shrugged eloquently. "About him only coming out at night. About those queer friends of his, too. You know Tom, who stokes the middle larboard? He'd been telling this story. Says that night we left Louisville, well, you remember how thick the skeeters were. Well, Tom says he saw that old Simon down on the main deck, just kind of looking around. And a skeeter landed on his hand, and he went and swatted it with his other hand. Squashed it. But you know how full-up skeeters get sometimes. So when you squash them, they just bust with the blood. Tom says that happened with the skeeter on the back of Simon's hand. So it smeared up all bloody when he got it. Only then, Tom tells it, that Simon just kind of stared at his hand for the longest while, then lifted it up, and damned if he didn't lick it clean." Abner Marsh scowled. "You tell your boy Tom that he better stop telling such stories, or he's going to be stoking the middle larboard on somebody else's steamer." Harry Mike nodded, brought his iron billet into his other hand with a meaty thwack, and turned to go. But Marsh stopped him. "No," he said, "wait. You tell him not to go spreading those stories. But if he sees anything else funny, he should come to you or to me. Tell him we'll give him a half dollar." "He'll lie for the half dollar." "Well, forget the half dollar then, but you tell him the rest of it." The more Abner thought about Tom's story, the more it bothered him. He was just as glad that Joshua York was going to install Simon as bartender, where he'd be out in public and the man could keep an eye on him. Marsh had never liked morticians. Simon still reminded him of one, something ungodly, when he didn't remind him of one of their patrons, that is. He only hoped that Simon didn't go licking up no mosquitoes while he was serving drinks to the cabin passengers.
That kind of thing could ruin a boat's reputation awful fast. Marsh soon put the incident out of his mind and plunged back into business. On the night before their scheduled departure, however, something else bothered him. He had called on Joshua York in his cabin to go over a few details of their trip. York was sitting at his desk, with his slim, ivory-handled knife in hand, slicing an article out of a newspaper. He and Marsh chatted briefly for a few minutes about the business at hand, and Marsh was about to take his leave when he noticed a copy of the Democrat on York's desk. "They were supposed to run one of our advertisements today," Marsh said, reaching for the paper. "You finished with this, Joshua?" York dismissed the paper with a wave of his hand. "Take it if you'd like," he said. Abner Marsh carried the paper under his arm to the main cabin and paged through it while Simon made him a drink. He was annoyed. He couldn't locate their advertisement. Of course, it might not be an omission. York had sliced out a story on the page that backed up the shipping news, so there was a hole just in the prime place. Marsh drained his glass, folded up the paper, and went forward to the clerk's office. "You got the latest number of the Democrat?" Marsh asked Jeffers. "I think that damn Blair left out my advertisement." "It's there yonder," Jeffers replied. "But he didn't. Look on the shipping page." And sure enough, there it was, a box smack in the middle of a column of similar boxes. Fever River Packet Company. "The splendid fleet steamer, Fever Dream, will leave for New Orleans, Louisiana, and all intermediate points and landings on Thursday, making the best time and manned by all experienced officers and crew. For freight or passage, apply on board or at the company office at the foot of Pine Street. Abner Marsh, President." Marsh inspected the advertisement, nodded, and flipped back a page to see what Joshua York had cut out. The item looked to be a reprint lifted from some downriver paper about some old no-count woodyard man found dead in his cabin on the river north of New Madrid. The mate of a steamer that had put in for wood found him when no one answered their calls. Some thought that Indians did it. Some others said wolves, since the body had been all ripped up and half-eaten. That was just about all it said. "Something wrong, Captain Marsh?" Jeffers asked. "You got a queer look on your face." Marsh folded up Jeffers' Democrat and stuck it under his arm with York's. "No, nothing. Damn paper just spelled a couple things wrong." Jeffers smiled. "Are you certain? I know spelling isn't your strong suit, Captain. Don't you go joshing me about that again, or I'll chuck you over the side, Mr. Jeffers," Marsh replied. "I'm going to be taking your paper, if you don't mind." "Go ahead," Jeffers said. "I'd finished." Back at the bar, Marsh reread the story about the woodyard man. Why should Joshua York be cutting out some item about some fool trash killed by wolves? Marsh couldn't figure an answer, but it bothered him. He looked up and noticed Simon's eyes on him in the big mirror over the bar. Marsh quickly folded up the Democrat again and stuffed it into a pocket. "Let me have a little glass of whiskey," he said. Marsh drank the whiskey straight down and made a long "ah" as the burning spread down through his chest. It cleared his head a mite. There were ways he could find out more about this, but then again it wasn't rightly his business what kind of newspaper stories Joshua York liked to read. Besides, he had given his word not to go prying into York's business, and Abner Marsh fancied himself a man of his word. Resolute, Marsh set down his glass and moved away from the bar. He clomped down the grand, curving stair to the main deck and tossed both newspapers into one of the dark furnaces. The deckhands looked at him strangely, but Marsh felt better immediately. A man shouldn't go around entertaining suspicions about his partner, especially one as generous and well-mannered as Joshua York. "What are you looking at?" he barked at the deckhand. "Ain't you got no work to do? I'll find Harry Mike and see he gets you some." Immediately the men were busy. Abner Marsh went back up to the main cabin and had himself another drink. The next morning Marsh went over to Pine Street, to his company's main office, and tended to business for several hours. He lunched at the planter's house, surrounded by old friends and old rivals, feeling grand. Marsh bragged up a storm about his steamer, and had to endure Farrell and O'Brien flapping their jaws about their boats. But that was all right. He just smiled and said, "Well, boys, maybe we'll meet on the river. Wouldn't that be grand?" Not a soul mentioned his previous misfortune, and three different men came up to his table and asked Marsh if he needed a pilot for the lower Mississippi. It was a fine couple of hours. Strolling back to the river, Marsh chanced to pass a tailor's shop. He hesitated, tugging at his beard thoughtfully while he mulled over an idea that had struck him real sudden. Then he went inside, grinning, and ordered up a new captain's coat for himself, a white one, with a double row of silver buttons, just like Joshua's. Marsh left $2 on account and arranged to pick up the coat when the Fever Dream returned to St. Louis. He left feeling very satisfied with himself. The riverfront was chaotic. A consignment of dry goods had arrived late, and the roustabouts were sweating to get it loaded up in time. Whitey had the steam up, all white plumes were rising from the skate pipes, and dark smoke rolled out of the chimney's flowered tops. The steamer to the left of the Fever Dream was backing out, with great gouts of smoke and much whistle-blowing and shouting. And the big side-wheeler to the right was unloading freight onto its wharf-boat, an old decrepit shell of a steamer tied permanently to the landing. All up and down the riverfront there were steamboats, as far as the eye could see in either direction, more boats than Marsh could count. 9 boats up was the luxurious, 3-decked John Simons, taking on passengers. Down from her was the side-wheeler Northern Light, with a picture of the Aurora painted gaudily on her paddle boxes. She was a brand-new Upper Mississippi steamer, and the Northwestern line said she was faster than any boat that had plied those waters yet. Coming downriver was the Gray Eagle, which the Northern Light was going to have to take to live up to her brag. There was the Northerner, and the crude, powerful stern-wheeler St. Joe, and the Di Vernon II, and the Natchez. Marsh looked at each of them in turn, at the intricate devices suspended between their chimneys, at their fancy jigsaw carpentry and their bright paint, at their hissing, billowing steam, at the power in their wheels. And then he looked at his own boat, the Fever Dream, all white and blue and silver, and it seemed to him that her steam rose higher than any of the others, and her whistle had a sweeter, clearer tone, and her paint was cleaner, and her wheels more formidable. And she stood taller than all but 3 or 4 of the other boats, and she was longer than just about any of them. "We'll take 'em all," he said to himself, and he went on down to his lady. Chapter 8. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, July 1857. Abner Marsh cut a wedge of cheddar from the wheel on the table, positioned it carefully atop what remained of his apple pie, and forked them both up with a quick motion of his big red hand. He belched, wiped his mouth with his napkin, and shook a few crumbs from his beard, and sat back with a smile on his face. "Good pie?" asked Joshua York, smiling at Marsh over a brandy snifter. "Toby don't bake no other kind," Marsh replied. "You should have tried a piece." He pushed away from the table and stood up. "Well, drink up, Joshua. It's time."
"Time?
You wanted to learn the river, didn't you? You ain't going to learn it setting the table, I'll tell you that much." York finished his brandy, and they went up to the pilot house together. Carl Fram was on duty. He was lounging on the couch, smoke curling up from his pipe, while his cub, a tall youth with lank blonde hair hanging down to his collar, worked as steersman.
"Captain Marsh?" Fram said, nodding. "And you must be the mysterious Captain York. Pleased to meet you. Never been on a steamer with 2 captains before."
He grinned, a wide, lopsided grin that flashed a gold tooth. "This boat got almost as many captains as I got wives. Of course, it stands to reason. Why, this boat got more boilers and more mirrors and more silver than any boat I ever seen, so it ought to have more captains, too, I figure."
The lanky pilot leaned forward and knocked some ashes from his pipe into the belly of the big iron stove. It was cold and dark, the night being hot and thick,
"What can I do for you, gentlemen?"
Fram asked.
"Learn us the river," said Marsh.
Fram's eyebrows rose.
"Learn you the river? I got myself a cub here. Ain't that right, Jody?"
"Sure is, Mr. Fram."
Fram smiled and shrugged. "Now I'm learning Jody here, and it's all been arranged. I'm to get $600 from the first wages he gets after he's been licensed and taken into the association. I'm only doing it so cheap 'cause I know his family. Can't say I know your families, though. Can't say that at all."
Joshua York undid the buttons on his dark gray vest. He was wearing a money belt. He brought out a $20 gold piece and placed it on top of the stove, the gold gleaming softly against the black iron.
20, said York.
He set another gold piece atop it. 40, he said. Then a third.
60.
When the count reached 300, York buttoned up his vest.
"I'm afraid that is all I have on me, Mr. Fram, but I assure you I am not without funds. Let us agree to $700 for yourself and an equal amount for Mr. Albright, if the two of you will instruct me in the rudiments of piloting and refresh Captain Marsh here so he can steer his own boat. Payable immediately, not from future wages. What say you?"
Fram was real cool about it, Marsh thought. He sucked on his pipe thoughtfully for a moment, like he was considering the offer, and finally reached out and took the stack of gold coins.
"Can't speak for Mr. Albright, but for myself, I was always fond of the color of gold. I'll learn you. What say you come on up tomorrow during the day, at the start of my watch?"
"That may be fine for Captain Marsh," York said, "but I prefer to begin immediately."
Fram looked around. "Hell," he said, "can't you see? It's night. Been learning Jody for near a year now, and it's only been a month I've been letting him steer by night. Running at night ain't never easy."
"No."
His tone was firm. "I'll learn you by day first, when a man can see where he's running to."
"I will learn by night. I keep strange hours, Mr. Fram. But you need not worry. I have excellent night vision, better than yours, I suspect."
The pilot unfolded his long legs, stood up, and stalked over and took the wheel.
"Go below, Jody," he said to his cub.
When the youth had gone, Fram said, "Ain't no man sees good enough to run a bad stretch of river in the dark." He stood with his back to them, intent on the black starlit waters ahead. Far up the river they could see the distant lights of another steamer.
"Tonight is a good clear night, no clouds to speak of, a half-decent moon, good stage on the river. Look at that water out there, like black glass. Look at the banks. Real easy to see where they're at, ain't it?"
"Yes," said York. Marsh, smiling, said nothing.
"Well," said Fram, "it ain't always like that. Sometimes there ain't no moon. Sometimes there's clouds covering everything. Gets awful black then. Yet so a man can't see much of nothing. The banks pull back so you can't see where they are. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can steer right into them. Other times you get shadows that hulk up like they were solid land, and you gotta know they ain't. Otherwise you'll spend half the night steering away from things that ain't really there."
"How do you suppose a pilot knows such things, Captain York?"
Fram gave him no chance to reply. He tapped his temple.
"By memory is how. By seeing the dern river by day and remembering it, all of it. Every bend and every house along the shore, every woodyard, where it runs deep and where it's shallow, where you got to cross. You pilot a steamer with what you know, Captain York, not with what you see. But you got to see before you can know, and you can't see good enough by night."
"That's the truth, Joshua,"
Abner Marsh affirmed, putting a hand up on York's shoulder. York said quietly, "The boat up ahead of us is a side-wheeler with what appears to be an ornate quay between her chimneys, and a pilot house with a domed roof. Right now she's passing a woodyard. There's an old rotten wharf there, and a colored man is sitting on the end of it, looking out at the river."
Marsh let go of York's shoulder and moved to the window, squinting. The other boat was a long way ahead. He could make out that she was a side-wheeler right enough, but the device between her chimneys, the chimneys were black against a black sky. He could barely see them, and then only because of the sparks flying from them. "Damn," he said. Bram glanced around at York with surprise in his eyes. "I can't make out half that stuff myself," he said. "But I do believe you're right." A few moments later, the fever dream steamed past the woodyard, and there was the old colored man, just like York had described. "He's smoking a pipe," Bram said, grinning. "You left that out." "Sorry," Joshua York said. "Well," said Bram thoughtfully. "Well," he chewed on his pipe, his eyes on the river ahead. "You surely do have good night eyes, I'll give you that. But I'm still not sure. It ain't hard to see a woodyard up ahead on a clear night. Seeing an old darky is a mite harder with the way they blend in and all. But still, that's one thing, and the river is another. There's lots of little things a pilot has got to see that your cabin passenger would never notice at all. The look of the water when a snag or a sawyer is hiding underneath it. Old dead trees that'll tell you the stage of the river 100 miles further on. The way to tell a bluff reef from a wind reef. You got to be able to read the river like it was a book, and the words is just little ripples and eddies, sometimes all faded so they can't be made out properly. And then you got to rely on what you remember about the last time you read that page. Now, you wouldn't go try reading a book in the dark, would you?" York ignored that. "I can see a ripple on the water as easily as I can see a woodyard, if I know what to look for. Mr. Fram, if you can't teach me the river, I'll find a pilot who can. I remind you that I am the owner and master of the fever dream." Fram glanced around again, frowning now. "More work by night," he said. "If you want to learn by night, it'll cost you 800. York's expression melted into a slow smile. "Done," he said. "Now, let us begin." Carl Fram pushed back his slouchy hat until it sat on the back of his head and gave a long sigh like a man who was inordinately put upon. "All right," he said. "It's your money, and your boat, too."